memory. She had actually thought of that once or twice, and mercifully had not quite brought herself to it. "Even a queen stubs her toe, but a wise woman watches the path," she quoted softly. Lini was a wise woman. Elaine did not think she would make that particular mistake again. She knew she made many, but seldom the same twice. One day, perhaps, she would make few enough to be worthy to follow her mother on the throne. Suddenly she sat up. Tears were leaking from Nynaeve's closed eyes, trickling down the sides of her face. What Elaine had taken for a faint snore, Nynaeve did snore, whatever she said, was a tiny whimpering sob deep in her throat. That should not be. If she had been injured, the hurt would have appeared, although she would not feel it here until she woke. Perhaps I should wake her. But she hesitated, even as her hand stretched toward the other woman. Waking someone out of Telairunriod was far from easy. Shaking, even icy water in the face, would not always do, and Nynaeve would not appreciate being pummeled awake after the bruising Sarandon had given her. I wonder what really happened. I will have to ask Sarandon. Whatever was going on, Nynaeve should be able to step out of the dream whenever she wished, unless... Egwene said that the Wise Ones could hold someone in Telairunriod against their will, though if they had taught her the trick, she had not passed it on to Elaine or Nynaeve. If someone was holding Nynaeve now, hurting her, it could not be Birgitta or the Wise Ones. Well, the Wise Ones might if they caught her wandering where they thought she should not, but if not them, that left only... She took hold of Nynaeve's shoulders to shake her. If that did not work, she would freeze the pitcher of water on the table, or slap her face silly. And Nynaeve's eyes popped open. Immediately, Nynaeve began to weep aloud, the most despairing sound Elaine had ever heard.
I killed her! Oh, Elaine, I killed her with my foolish pride, thinking I could...
The words trailed off in open-mouthed sobs.
You killed who?
It could not be Mokadine. That woman's death would surely not bring this grief. She was about to take Nynaeve in her arms to comfort her when a pounding came at the door.
Send them away, Nynaeve mumbled, curling herself into a trembling ball in the middle of the bed.
Sighing, Elaine made her way to the door and pulled it open, but before she could say a word, Tom pushed past her out of the night, rumpled shirt bagging out of his breeches, carrying someone shrouded in his cloak in his arms. Only a woman's bare feet showed.
She was just there, Julin said behind him, as if he did not believe the words coming out of his own mouth.
Both men were barefoot, and Julin was stripped to the waist, lean and hairless-chested.
I woke for a moment, and suddenly she was standing there, naked as the day she was born, collapsing like a cut net.
She's alive, Tom said, laying the cloak-wrapped figure on Elaine's bed, but only barely. I could hardly hear her heart.
Frowning, Elaine pulled aside the cloak's hood and found herself staring at Birgitta's face, pale and wan. Nynaeve scrambled stiffly from the other bed to kneel beside the unconscious woman. Her face glistened with tears, but her weeping had stopped.
She is alive, she breathed. She is alive!
Abruptly, she seemed to realize that she was in her shift in front of the men, but she barely spared them a glance, and all she said was, Get them out of here, Elaine. I can do nothing with them gawking like sheep. Tom and Julin rolled their eyes toward each other when Elaine made a herding motion at them and shook their heads slightly, but they backed toward the door without complaint.
She is a friend, Elaine told them.
She felt as if she were moving in a dream, floating without feeling. How could this be?
We will take care of her.
How could it possibly have happened? Now don't say a word to anyone. The looks they gave her as she closed the door nearly made her blush. Of course they knew better than to talk. But men did have to be reminded of the simplest things sometimes, even Tom.
Nynaeve, how under the light, she began, turning, and cut off as the glow of Sidar surrounded the kneeling woman.
Burn her, Nynaeve growled, channeling fiercely. Burn her forever for doing this.
Elaine recognized the flows being woven for healing, but recognition was as far as she could go.
"I will find her, Birgitta," Nynaeve muttered.
Strands of spirit predominated, but water and air were in there, and even earth and fire. It looked as complicated as embroidering one dress with either hand and two more with your feet, blindfolded.
"I will make her pay."
The glow shining about Nynaeve grew and grew until it overwhelmed the lamps, until it hurt to look at her except through slitted eyes.
"I swear it! By the light and my hope of salvation and rebirth, I will!"
The anger in her voice changed, becoming deeper, if anything.
"It isn't working. There is nothing wrong with her to heal. She is as perfect as anyone can be. But she is dying. Oh, light! I can feel her slipping away! Burn, Mogadine! Burn her and burn me along with her!"
She was not giving up, though. The weaving continued, complex flows weaving into Birgitta. And the woman lay there, golden braid flung over the side of the bed, the rise and fall of her chest slowing.
"I can do something that might help," Elaine said slowly.
"You were supposed to have permission, but it had not always been so. Once it had been done almost as often without as with. There was no reason it should not work on a woman, except that she had never heard of it being done to any but men."
"Linking?"
Nynaeve did not look away from the woman on the bed or stop her efforts with the power.
"Yes, you will have to do it. I don't know how, but let me guide. I do not know half of what I am doing right this minute, but I know that I can do it. You could not heal a bruise."
Elaine's mouth tightened, but she let the remark lie.
"Not linking."
The amount of Sidar that Nynaeve had drawn into herself was amazing. If she could not heal Birgitta with that, what Elaine could add would not make a difference. Together they would be stronger than either apart, but not as strong as if their two strengths were simply added. Besides, she was not certain that she could link. She'd only been linked once, and an Aes Sedai had done it, to show her what it was like, more than how.
"Stop, Nynaeve. You said yourself it is not working. Stop and let me try.
If it doesn't work, you can..."
She could what? If healing worked, it worked. If it did not, there was no point in trying again if it failed.
"Try what?"
Nynaeve snapped, yet she moved away awkwardly, letting Elaine come close. The weave of healing faded, but not the shining nimbus. Instead of answering, Elaine put one hand on Birgitta's forehead. Physical contact was as necessary for this as for healing, and the two times she had watched it done in the tower, the Aes Sedai had touched the man's forehead. The flows of spirit she wove were complex, if not so intricate as Nynaeve's of a moment before. She barely understood some of what she was doing, and none at all of other parts, yet she had paid close attention from her hiding place to how the weave was shaped. Watched closely, because she had built up a stock of stories in her head, made silly romances where there so seldom were any. After a moment she sat down on the other bed and let Sidar go. Nynaeve frowned at her, then bent to examine Birgitta. The unconscious woman's color was perhaps a little better, her breathing a little stronger.
"What did you do, Elaine?"
Nynaeve did not take her eyes from Birgitta, but the glow around her faded away slowly.
"It wasn't healing. I think I could do it myself now, but it was not healing."
"Will she live?"
Elaine asked faintly. There was no visible link between her and Birgitta, no flows, but she could sense the woman's weakness, a terrible weakness. She would know the moment Birgitta died, even if she was sleeping or hundreds of miles away.
"I do not know. She isn't fading anymore, but I do not know."
Weariness made Nynaeve's voice soft, and pain touched it strongly, as if she shared Birgitta's injury. Wincing, she rose and unfolded a red-striped blanket to spread over the woman lying there.
"What did you do?"
Silence held Elaine long enough for Nynaeve to join her, lowering herself awkwardly onto the bed.
"Bonding,"
Elaine said finally.
"I bonded her. As a warder."
The incredulous stare on the other woman's face made her rush on.
Healing was doing no good. I had to do something. You know the gifts a warder gets from being bonded. One is strength, energy. He can keep going when other men would collapse and die, survive wounds that would kill anyone else. It was the only thing I could think of.
Nynaeve drew a deep breath. Well, it is working better than what I did, at least. A woman warder. I wonder what Lan will think of that. No reason why she shouldn't be. If any woman can, it would be her.
Wincing, she curled her legs up beneath her. Her gaze kept returning to Birgitta.
You will have to keep this secret. If anyone learns that an accepted has bonded a warder, whatever the circumstances...
Elaine shivered.
I know, she said simply and quite fervently.
It was not quite a stilling offense, but any Aes Sedai would very likely make her wish she had been stilled.
Nynaeve, what happened?
For a long moment she thought the other woman was going to start crying again as her chin quivered and her lips worked. When she began speaking, her voice was iron, her face a blend of fury and too many tears ever to be shed. She told the tale starkly, almost sketchily, until she came to Mogadine's appearance among the wagons. That she rendered in painful detail.
I should be welted from the neck down, she said bitterly at last, touching a smooth, unmarked arm. Unmarked or not, she flinched.
I don't understand why I am not. I feel it, but I deserve the welts for stupid, foolish pride, for being too afraid to do what I should. I deserved being hung up like a ham in a smokehouse. If there was any justice, I would still be dangling there, and Birgitta would not be lying on that bed, with us wondering whether she'll live or not. If only I knew more. If only I could have Mogadine's knowledge for 5 minutes, I could heal her. I am sure of it.
If you were still hanging, Elaine said practically, in a very short while you would be waking up and shielding me. I don't doubt Mogadine would have seen to it that you were angry enough to channel. She knows us all too well, remember. And I do doubt very much that I would have suspected anything until you had done it. I do not fancy being carted off to Mogadine, and I cannot believe you do either.
The other woman did not look at her.
It must have been a link, Nynaeve, like an eidam. That is how she made you feel pain without marking you.
Nynaeve still sat there in a glowering sulk.
Nynaeve, Birgitta is alive. You did everything you could for her, and the light willing, she will live. It was Mogadine who did this to her, not you. A soldier who takes blame for comrades who fall in battle is a fool. You and I are soldiers in a battle, but you are not a fool, so stop behaving like one.
Nynaeve did look at her then, a scowl that lasted only a moment before she turned her face completely away.
You don't understand.
Her voice sank almost to a whisper.
She was one of the heroes bound to the wheel of time, destined to be born again and again to make legends. She wasn't born this time, Elaine. She was ripped out of Tel Iron Riad as she stood. Is she still bound to the wheel? Or has she been ripped away from that, too? Ripped away from what her own courage earned her because I was so proud, so man-stubborn, stupid, that I made her hunt for Mogadine.
Elaine had hoped that those questions had not occurred to Nynaeve yet, would not until she had had a little time to recover first.
Do you know how badly Mogadine was hurt?
Maybe she is dead.
I hope not, the other woman almost snarled. I want to make her pay.
She took a deep breath, but instead of invigorating her, it seemed to make her sag.
I would not count on her dying. Birgitta's shot missed her heart. A wonder she managed to hit the woman at all, staggering as she was. I would not have stood up if I were thrown that far, hard enough to bounce like that. I couldn't even stand up after what Mogadine did to me. No, she is alive, and we had best believe that she can have her wound healed and be after us by morning.
She would still need time to rest, Nynaeve, you know that. Can she even know where we are? From what you said, she had no time to do more than see that this is a menagerie.
What if she did see more?
Nynaeve rubbed her temples as if it were difficult to think. What if she knows exactly where we are? She could send Dark Friends after us, or send word to Dark Friends in Samara. Luca is livid because 11 menageries are already around the city, and 3 more are waiting to cross the bridge. Nynaeve, it will take her days to regain strength after a wound like that, even if she does find some black sister to heal her, or one of the other Forsaken. And more days to search through 15 menageries. That is, if there are not more on the road behind us or coming from Altara. If she does come after us or send Dark Friends, either one, we are forewarned, and we have days to find a boat that can carry us downriver. She paused a moment, thinking, "Do you have anything to dye your hair in that bag of herbs? I'll wager anything that you had your hair braided in Tel Irunriod. Mine is always its real color there. If yours is loose, as it is now, and another color, it will make us that much harder to find." "White cloaks everywhere," Nynaeve sighed. "Galad, the prophet, no boats. It is as if everything is conspiring to hold us here for Mogadin. I'm so tired, Elaine. Tired of being afraid of who might be around the next corner. Tired of being afraid of Mogadin. I cannot seem to think of what to do next. My hair? Nothing that would make it any color I'd have." "You need to sleep," Elaine said firmly. "Without the ring. Give it to me." The other woman hesitated, but Elaine merely waited with her hand outstretched until Nynaeve fished the flecked stone ring from the cord around her neck. Stuffing it into her pouch, Elaine went on, "Now you lie down here and I will watch Brigitta." Nynaeve stared at the woman stretched out on the other bed for a moment, then shook her head. "I can't sleep. I need to be alone. To walk." Getting to her feet as stiffly as if she really had been beaten, she took her dark cloak from its peg and swung it over her shift. At the door, she paused. "If she wants to kill me," she said bleakly, "I do not know that I could make myself stop her." She went into the night, barefoot and sad-faced. Elaine hesitated, unsure which woman needed her more, before settling back where she sat. Nothing she said could make things better for Nynaeve, but she had faith in the woman's resilience. Time alone to work it all over in her mind, and she would see that blame lay at Mukadine's door, not hers. She had to. Chapter 36. A New Name. For a long time Elaine sat there watching Brigitta sleep. It did seem to be sleep. Once she stirred, muttering in a desperate voice, "Wait for me, Gadel. Wait. I'm coming, Gadel. Wait for—" Words trailed off into slow breath again. Was it stronger? The woman still looked deathly ill, better than she had, but pale and drawn. After perhaps an hour, Nynaeve returned, her feet dirty. Fresh tears shone on her cheeks. "I could not stay away," she said, hanging her cloak back on its peg. "You sleep. I will watch her. I have to watch her." Elaine rose slowly, smoothing her skirts. Perhaps watching over Brigitta for a time would help Nynaeve work matters out. "I don't feel like sleeping yet either." She was exhausted, but not sleepy any longer. "I think I will stroll outside myself." Nynaeve only nodded as she took Elaine's place on the bed, her dusty feet dangling over the side, her eyes fastened to Brigitta. To Elaine's surprise, Tom and Julin were not asleep either. They had built a small fire beside the wagon and sat on either side of it, cross-legged on the ground, smoking their long-stemmed pipes. Tom had tucked his shirt in and Julin had donned his coat, though no shirt, and turned the cuffs back. She took a look around before joining them. No one stirred in the camp, dark except for the light of this one fire and the glow of the lamps from their wagon's windows. Neither man said anything while she settled her skirts. Then Julin looked at Tom, who nodded, and the thief-catcher took something from the ground and held it out to her. "I found it where she was lying," the dark man said, "as if it had dropped from her hand." Elaine took the silver arrow slowly. Even the fletching feathers appeared to be silver. "Distinctive,"
Tom said conversationally around his pipe. And added to the braid. Every story mentions the braid for some reason, though I've found some I think might be her under other names without it, and some under other names with.
I do not care about stories, Julin put in. He sounded no more agitated than Tom, but then it took a great deal to agitate either one of them.
Is it her? Bad enough if it isn't, a woman appearing naked out of nothing like that, but what have you gotten us into, you and Nana? He was troubled. Julin did not make mistakes, and his tongue never slipped. Tom merely bubbled at his pipe, waiting.
Elaine turned the arrow in her hands, pretending to study it.
She is a friend, she said finally. Unless Birgitta released her, her promise held.
She is not Aes Sedai, but she has been helping us.
They looked at her, waiting for her to say more.
Why didn't you give this to Nynaeve?
One of those glances passed between them. Men seemed to carry on entire conversations through glances, around women at least, saying as clearly as spoken words what they thought of her keeping secrets, especially when they all but knew for certain already. But she had given her word.
She seemed upset, Julin said, sucking at his pipe judiciously, and Tom took his from between his teeth and blew out his white mustaches.
Upset? The woman came out in her shift looking lost, and when I asked if I could help her, she didn't snap my head off. She cried on my shoulder.
He plucked at his linen shirt, muttering something about dampness.
Elaine, she apologized for every cross word she has ever said to me, which is very nearly every other word out of her mouth. Said she ought to be switched, or maybe that she had been. She was incoherent half the time. She said she was a coward and a stubborn fool. I don't know what is the matter with her, but she isn't herself by a mile.
I knew a woman who behaved like this once, Julin said, peering into the fire. She woke to find a burglar in her bedchamber and stabbed the man through the heart. Only when she lit a lamp, it was her husband. His boat had come back to the docks early. She walked around like Nynaeve for half a month. His mouth tightened. Then she hanged herself.
I hate to lay this burden on you, child, Tom added gently. But if she can be helped, you are the only one of us who can do it. I know how to take a man out of his miseries. Give him a swift kick, or else get him drunk and find him a...
He harrumphed loudly, trying to make it seem a cough, and knuckled his mustaches.
The one bad thing about him seeing her as a daughter was that now sometimes he seemed to think she was perhaps 12.
Anyway, the point is that I do not know how to do this, and while Julin might be willing to dandle her on his knee, I doubt she'd thank him for it.
I would sooner dandle a fangfish, the thief-catcher muttered, but not as roughly as he would have yesterday. He was as concerned as Tom, though less willing to admit it.
I will do what I can, she assured them, turning the arrow again. They were good men, and she did not like lying to them or hiding things from them, not unless it was absolutely necessary, anyway. Nynaeve claimed that you had to manage men for their own good, but there was such a thing as taking it too far. It was not right to lead a man into dangers he knew nothing of. So she told them. About Tel Iron Riad and the Forsaken being loose, about Mogadine. Not quite everything, of course. Some events in Tanchico had been too shaming for her to want to think of them. Her promise held her concerning Birgitta's identity, and there was certainly no need to go into detail about what Mogadine had done to Nynaeve. It made explaining this night's happenings a little difficult, yet she managed. She did tell them everything she thought they should know, enough to make them aware for the first time what they were really up against. Not just the Black Aja. That had certainly made them stare cross-eyed when they learned it. But the Forsaken, and one of them very likely hunting her and Nynaeve. And she made it quite plain that they too would be hunting Mogadine as well, and that anyone close to them was in danger of being caught between hunter and prey either way.
Now that you know, she finished, the choice to stay or go is yours.
She left it at that, and was careful not to look at Tom. She hoped almost desperately that he would stay, but she would not let him think that she was asking, not by so much as a glance.
"I haven't taught you half what you need to know if you're to be as good a queen as your mother," he said, trying to sound gruff and spoiling it by brushing a strand of black-dyed hair from her cheek with a gnarled finger. "You'll not rid yourself of me this easily, child. I mean to see you mistress of Desdemar if I must drone in your ear until you go deaf. I haven't even taught you to handle a knife. I tried to teach your mother, but she always said she could tell a man to use a knife if one needed using. Fool way to look at it." She leaned forward and kissed his leathery cheek, and he blinked, bushy eyebrows shooting up, then smiled and stuck his pipe back into his mouth. "You can kiss me, too," Jewelin said dryly. "Randall Thor will have my guts for fish bait if I don't hand you back to him in the same health he last saw you." Elaine lifted her chin. "I will not have you stay for Randall Thor, Jewelin." "Hand her back, indeed. You will stay only if you want to, and I do not release you, or you, Tom," he had grinned at the thief-catcher's comment, "from your promise to do as you were told." Tom's startled look was quite satisfying. She turned back to Jewelin. "You will follow me, and Nynaeve, of course, knowing full well the enemies we face, or you may pack your belongings and ride Skulker where you wish. I will give him to you." Jewelin sat up straight as a post, his dark face going darker. "I have never abandoned a woman in danger in my life." He pointed his pipe stem at her like a weapon. "You send me away, and I will be on your heels like a soarer on a stern chase." Not exactly what she wanted, but it would do. "Very well, then." Rising, she held herself erect, the silver arrow at her side, and kept her slightly frosty manner. She thought they had finally realized who was in charge. "Morning is not far off." Had Rand actually had the nerve to tell Jewelin to hand her back? Tom would just have to suffer along with the other man for a time, and it served him right for that grin. "You will put out this fire and go to sleep. Now. No excuses, Tom. You'll be no good at all tomorrow without sleep." Obediently, they began scuffing dirt over the flames with their boots, but when she reached the plain wooden steps of the wagon, she heard Tom say, "Sounds like her mother sometimes." "Then I am glad I have never met the woman," Jewelin grumbled in reply. "Flip for first guard?" Tom murmured an assent. She almost went back, but found herself smiling instead. Men. It was a fond thought. Her good mood lasted until she was inside. Nynaeve sat on the very edge of the bed, holding herself up with both hands, eyes trying to drift shut as she watched Birgitta. Her feet were still dirty. Elaine put Birgitta's arrow into one of the cupboards behind some rough sacks of dried peas. Luckily, the other woman never so much as glanced at her. She did not think the sight of the silver arrow was what Nynaeve needed right at that moment. But what was? "Nynaeve, it is past time for you to wash your feet and go to sleep." Nynaeve swayed in her direction, blinking sleepily. "Feet? What? I must watch her." It would have to be one step at a time. "Your feet, Nynaeve, they are dirty. Wash them." Frowning, Nynaeve peered down at her dusty feet, then nodded. She spilled water, tipping the big white pitcher over the wash basin, and sloshed more out before she was washed and ready to towel dry, but even then she resumed her seat. "I must watch, in case... She cried out once, for Gadel." Elaine pressed her back on the mattress. "You need sleep, Nynaeve. You can't keep your eyes open." "I can," Nynaeve muttered sullenly, trying to sit up against Elaine's pressure on her shoulders. "I must watch her, Elaine. I must." Nynaeve made the two men outside look sensible and biddable. Even if Elaine had had a mind to, there was no way to get her drunk and find her a pretty young man, she supposed it would have to be. That left a swift kick. Sympathy and common sense had surely made no impression. "I have had enough of this sulking and self-pity, Nynaeve," she said firmly. "You are going to sleep now, and in the morning you are not going to say one word about what a miserable wretch you are. If you cannot behave like the clear-headed woman you are, I will ask Sarandon to give you two black eyes for the one I took away.
You did not even thank me for that. Now go to sleep.
Nynaeve's eyes widened indignantly. At least she did not look on the point of tears, but Elaine slid them shut with her fingers. They closed easily, and despite softly murmured protests, the deep, slow breath of sleep followed quickly. Elaine patted Nynaeve's shoulder before straightening. She hoped it was a peaceful sleep with dreams of Lan, but any sort of sleep was better for her now than none. Fighting a yawn, she bent to check Birgitta. She could not tell whether the woman's color or breathing was any better. There was nothing to do but wait and hope. The lamps did not seem to be bothering either of the women, so she left them alight and sat on the floor between the beds. They should help keep her awake. Not that she knew why she should remain awake, really. She had done what she could, as much as Nynaeve had. Unthinkingly, she leaned back against the front wall, and her chin sank slowly to her chest. The dream was a pleasant one, if odd. Rand knelt before her, and she put a hand on his head and bonded him as her warder. One of her warders. She would have to choose green now, with Birgitta. There were other women there, faces changing between one glance and the next. Nynaeve, Min, Moiraine, Avienda, Berylaine, Amathera, Leandrin, others she did not know. Whoever they were, she knew that she had to share him with them, because in the dream she was certain that that was what Min had viewed. She was not sure how she felt about that. Some of those faces she wanted to claw to shreds, but if it was fated by the pattern, it would have to be. Yet she would have one thing of him the others could never have, the bond between Warder and Aes Sedai. "Where is this place?" Berylaine said, raven-haired and so beautiful that Elaine wanted to bare her teeth. The woman wore the low-cut red dress that Luca wanted Nynaeve to wear. She always dressed revealingly. "Wake up! This is not Tel Iron Riod." Elaine started awake to find Birgitta leaning over the side of the bed, gripping her arm weakly. Her face was too pale and damp with sweat as if a fever had broken, but her blue eyes were sharp and intent on Elaine's face. "This is not Tel Iron Riod." It was not a question, but Elaine nodded, and Birgitta sank back with a long sigh. "I remember everything," she whispered. "I am here as I am, and I remember. All is changed. Gadol is out there somewhere, an infant, or even a young boy. But even if I find him, what will he think of a woman more than old enough to be his mother?" She scrubbed angrily at her eyes, muttering, "I do not cry. I never cry. I remember that, the light helped me. I never cry." Elaine got up on her knees beside the woman's bed. "You will find him, Birgitta." She kept her voice low. Nynaeve still seemed sound asleep. A small, rasping snore rose from her regularly, but she needed rest, not to confront this all over again now. "Somehow you will, and he will love you. I know he will." "Do you think that is what matters? I could stand him not loving me." Her glistening eyes gave her the lie. "He will need me, Elaine, and I will not be there. He always has more courage than is good for him. I always must supply him with caution. Worse, he will wander, searching for me, not knowing what he is looking for, not knowing why he feels incomplete. We are always together, Elaine, two halves of a whole." The tears welled up, flowing across her face. "Mogadine said she would make me cry forever, and she—" Suddenly her features contorted. Low, ragged sobs came as if ripped from her throat. Elaine gathered the taller woman into her arms, murmuring words of comfort she knew were useless. How would she feel if Rand were taken away from her? The thought was nearly enough to make her put her head down atop Birgitta's and join her weeping. She was not sure how long it took Birgitta to cry herself out, but eventually she pushed Elaine away and settled back, wiping her cheeks with her fingers. "I have never done that except as a small child. Never." Twisting her neck, she frowned at Nynaeve, still asleep on the other bed. "Did Mogadine hurt her badly?" "I have not seen anyone trust like that since the Turag took Marish." Elaine must have looked confused, because she added, "In another age, is she hurt?" "Not badly. Her spirit, mainly.
What you did allowed her to escape, but only after...
Elaine could not make herself say it. Too many wounds were too fresh. She blames herself. She thinks that everything is her fault for asking you to help.
If she had not asked me, Mogadine would be teaching her to beg right now. She has as little caution as Gadel.
Brigitta's dry tone sounded odd with her wet cheeks.
She did not drag me into this by my hair. If she claims responsibility for the consequences, then she claims responsibility for my actions. If anything, she sounded angry. I am a free woman, and I made my own choices. She did not decide for me.
I must say you are taking this better than I would.
She could not say better than Nynaeve. That was true, but the other was as well. I always say, if you must mount the gallows, give a jest to the crowd, a coin to the hangman, and make the drop with a smile on your lips.
Birgitta's smile was grim.
Mogadine sprang the trap, but my neck is not yet snapped. Perhaps I will surprise her before it is done.
The smile faded into a frown as she studied Elaine.
I can feel you. I think I could close my eyes and point to you a mile away.
Elaine took a very deep breath.
I bonded you as a warder, she said in a rush. You were dying, and healing did no good, and...
The woman was looking at her, not frowning any more, but her eyes were disconcertingly sharp.
There was no other choice, Birgitta. You would have died else.
A warder, Birgitta said slowly. I think I remember hearing a tale of a female warder, but it was in a life so long ago that I cannot remember more than that. It was time for another deep breath, and this time she had to force the words.
There is something you should know. You will discover it sooner or later, and I've decided not to keep things from people who have a right to know, not unless I absolutely must.
A third breath.
I'm not Aes Sedai. I'm only accepted.
For a long moment the golden-braided woman stared up at her, then slowly shook her head.
An accepted.
In the Trolloc Wars I knew an accepted who bonded a fellow. Barashel was due to be tested the next day for raising to full Aes Sedai, and certain to be given the shawl, but she was afraid that a woman testing that same day would take him. In the Trolloc Wars the Tower tried to raise women as quickly as possible, from necessity.
What happened? Elaine could not stop herself from asking. Barashel? That name sounded familiar.
Lacing her fingers over the blanket atop her bosom, Birgitta shifted her head on the pillow and put on a look of mock sympathy.
Needless to say, she was not allowed to take the tests once it was discovered. Necessity did not outweigh such an offense. They made her pass the poor fellow's bond to another, and to teach her patience, put her into the kitchens among the scullions and spitgirls. I heard that she stayed there 3 years, and when she did receive her shawl, the Ammerlin Seat herself chose her warder, a leather-faced, stone-stubborn man named Ancelan. I saw them a few years after, and I could not tell which of them gave the commands. I do not think Barashel was certain either.
Not pleasant, Elaine muttered.
3 years in the...
Wait.
Barashel and Ancelan? It could not be the same pair. That story said nothing about Barashel being Aes Sedai, but she had read two versions and heard Tom tell another, and all had Barashel doing some long, arduous service to earn Ancelan's love. 2,000 years could change a great deal in a story.
Not pleasant, Birgitta agreed, and suddenly her eyes were much too large and innocent in her pale face.
I suppose, since you wish me to keep your dreadful secret, you will not ride me as hard as some Aes Sedai ride their warders. It would not do to push me to tell just to escape you.
Elaine's chin came up instinctively.
That sounds very like a threat. I do not take well to threats from you or anyone else. If you think...
The reclining woman caught her arm and cut her off apologetically. Her grip was noticeably stronger.
Please... I did not intend it that way.
Gadol claims I have a sense of humor like a rock tossed into a shoja circle. A cloud swept across her face at Gadol's name and was gone. You saved my life, daughter heir of Andor. I will keep your secret and serve you as warder, and be your friend if you will have me. I will be proud to have you for friend. Shoja circle? She would ask another time. Birgitta might be stronger, but she needed rest, not questions. And for warder. It seemed that she really was going to choose the green Aja. Aside from everything else, that was the only way she could bond Rand. The dream was still clear in her mind, and she intended to convince him to accept it one way or another. Perhaps you could try to moderate your sense of humor? I will try. Birgitta sounded as if she were saying she would try to pick up a mountain. But if I am to be your warder, even in secret, then I will be warder to you. You can barely hold your eyes open. It is time for you to sleep. Elaine's eyebrows and chin shot up together, but the woman gave her no opportunity to speak. Among many other things, it is a warder's place to tell her, Aes Sedai, when she pushes herself too hard. Also to provide a dose of caution when she thinks she can walk into the pit of doom, and to keep her alive so she can do what she must. I will do these things for you. Never fear for your back when I am near, Elaine. She did need sleep, she supposed, but Birgitta needed it more. Elaine dimmed the lamps and got the woman settled and asleep, though not until Birgitta had seen her put a pillow and blankets on the floor between the beds for herself. There was some slight argument over who would sleep on the floor, but Birgitta was still weak enough that Elaine had no trouble making her stay in the bed. Well, not very much, anyway. At least Nynaeve's soft snore never broke. She herself did not go to sleep immediately, whatever she had told Birgitta. The woman could not put her nose outside the wagon until she had something to wear, and she was taller than Elaine or Nynaeve. Sitting down between the beds, Elaine began letting out the hem on her dark gray silk riding dress. There would hardly be time in the morning for more than a quick fitting and stitching the new hem. Sleep overtook her with her ripping no more than half done. She had the dream of bonding Rand again, more than once. Sometimes he knelt voluntarily, and sometimes she had to do what she had done with Birgitta, even sneaking into his bedchamber while he slept. Birgitta was one of the other women now. Elaine did not mind that too much. Not her, or Min, or Egwene, or Avienda, or Nynaeve, though she could not imagine what Lan would say to that last. Others, though. She had just ordered Birgitta in a warder's color-shifting cloak to drag Berylaine and Elida to the kitchens for 3 years, when suddenly the two women began pummeling her. She awakened to find Nynaeve trampling her to reach Birgitta and check on the woman. The gray light just before dawn showed in the small windows. Birgitta woke claiming she was as strong as ever, and ravenous besides. Elaine was not certain whether Nynaeve had finished her bout of self-blame. She did not wring her hands or speak of it, but while Elaine washed her face and hands and explained about the menagerie and why they had to remain with it a while longer, Nynaeve hastily peeled and cored red pears and yellow apples, sliced cheese, and handed it all to Birgitta on a plate with a cup of watered wine with honey and spices. She would have fed the woman had Birgitta let her. Nynaeve washed Birgitta's hair in white hen pepper herself until it was as black as Elaine's. Elaine did her own, of course, donated her best stockings and shift, and looked disappointed when a pair of Elaine's slippers fit better. She insisted on helping Birgitta into the gray silk as soon as her hair had been toweled dry and braided again. The hips and bosom needed letting out, too, but that would have to wait, and even wanted to stitch the hem herself, until Elaine's incredulous stare made her retreat to her own ablutions, muttering as she scrubbed her face that she could sew as well as anyone, when she wanted to. When they went outside at last, the first sharp golden edge of the sun was peeking above the trees to the east. For this little while, the day felt deceptively comfortable. There was not a cloud to be seen in the sky, and by noon the air would be hot and gritty. Tom and Julin were hitching the team to the wagon, and the whole camp bustled in preparation for moving.
Skulker was already saddled, and Elaine made a note to herself to speak up about riding today herself before one of the men took possession of the saddle. Even if Tom or Julian got there first, though, she would not be too disappointed. This very afternoon she would high-walk in front of people for the first time. The costume Luca had shown her made her a little nervous, but at least she was not moaning about it as Nynaeve did. Luca himself came striding rapidly through the camp, red cloak fluttering behind, chivying and shouting unneeded instructions. "Latel, wake those bloody bears. I want them on their feet, snarling when we drive through Samara. Clarine, you watch those dogs this time. If one of them goes chasing after a cat again, Brug, you and your brothers do your tumbling just ahead of my wagon, mind. Just ahead. This is supposed to be a stately procession, not a race to see which of you can backflip the fastest. Sarandon, keep those boar horses in hand. I want people to gasp in amazement, not run in terror." He stopped at their wagon, glowering at Nynaeve and herself equally, with a bit left over for Birgitta. "Kind of you to decide to come with the rest of us, Mistress Nana, my Lady Morellin. I thought you meant to sleep until midday." He nodded toward Birgitta. "Having a chat with someone from across the river, are you? Well, we've no time for visitors. I mean to be set up and performing by noon." Nynaeve looked taken aback by the onslaught, but by the end of his second sentence she was meeting him glare for glare. Whatever her awkwardness toward Birgitta, it apparently did not hinder her temper where others were concerned. "We will be ready as soon as anyone, and you know it, Valen Luca. Besides, an hour or two will make no difference anyway. There are enough people gathered on the other side of the river that if 1 in 100 comes to your show, it will be more than you ever dreamed. If we decide to make a leisurely breakfast, you can just twiddle your thumbs and wait. You'll not get what you want if you leave us behind." That was her bluntest reminder yet of the promised 100 gold marks, but for once it did not slow him. "Enough people? Enough people? People must be attracted, woman. Chin Akima has been in place 3 days, and he has a fellow who juggles swords and axes. And 9 acrobats. 9! Some woman I've never heard of has 2 women acrobats who do things on a hanging rope that would make the Chavana's eyes pop. You would not believe the crowds. Cilia Serrano has men with their faces painted like court fools, splashing each other with water and hitting each other over the head with bladders, and people are paying an extra silver penny just to watch." Suddenly his eyes narrowed, focusing on Birgitta. "Would you be willing to paint your face? Cilia doesn't have a woman among her fools. Some of the horse handlers would be willing. It doesn't hurt getting hit with an inflated bladder, and I will pay you—" He trailed off, musing. He did not like parting with money any more than Nynaeve did, and Birgitta spoke into his momentary silence. "I am not a fool, and will not be a fool. I am an archer." "An archer," he muttered, eyeing the intricate glossy black braid pulled over her left shoulder. "And I suppose you call yourself Birgitta. What are you? One of those idiots hunting the Horn of Valir? Even if the thing exists, what chance any one of you will find it more than another? I was in Ilion when the hunter's oaths were given, and there were thousands in the great square of Tamaz. But for glory that you can attain, nothing can outshine the applause of—" "I am an archer, pretty man," Birgitta broke in firmly. "Fetch a bow, and I will outshoot you or anyone you name. 100 crowns gold to your 1. Elaine expected Nynaeve to yelp. It was they who would have to cover the wager if Birgitta lost, and whatever she claimed, Elaine did not think Birgitta could be fully recovered already. Yet all Nynaeve did was close her eyes briefly and draw a deep, long breath. "Women!" Luca growled. Tom and Julian did not have to look as if they agreed. "You are a fine match for the Lady Morellin and Nana, or whatever their names are." He swept his silk cloak in a wide gesture at the surrounding hustle of men and horses. "It may have escaped your keen eye, Birgitta, but I have a show to get underway, and my rivals are already draining Samara of coin like the cut-purses they are." Birgitta smiled, a slight curving of her lips. "Are you afraid, pretty man? We can make your side a silver penny." Elaine thought Luca might have apoplexy from the color that crept into his face.
His neck suddenly looked too big for his collar.
"I will fetch my bow," he almost hissed. "You can work off the 100 marks with your face painted or cleaning cages for all I care."
"Are you sure that you are well enough?" Elaine asked Birgitta as he stalked off, muttering to himself. The only word she caught was a repeat of "women." Nynaeve was looking at the woman with the braid as if she wanted the ground to open and swallow her. Herself, not Birgitta. A number of the horse handlers had gathered around Tom and Julin for some reason.
"He has nice legs," Birgitta said. "But I have never liked tall men. Add a pretty face, and they are always insufferable."
Petra had joined the group of men, twice as wide as any other. He said something, then shook hands with Tom. The Chavanas were there as well, and Latel, talking earnestly with Tom while darting dark looks at Nynaeve and the two women with her. By the time Luca returned with an unstrung bow and a quiver of arrows, no one was making preparations any longer. The wagons and horses and cages, even the tethered boar horses, stood abandoned, the people all clustered around Tom and the thief-catcher. They followed as Luca led the way a short distance out of the camp.
"I am accounted a fair shot," he said, carving a white cross chest-high to himself on the trunk of a tall oak. He had some of his jauntiness back, and he swaggered as he strode off 50 paces. "I will take the first shot so you can see what you face."
Birgitta plucked the bow from his hand and walked off another 50 as he stared after her. She shook her head over the bow, but braced it on her slippered foot and strung it in one smooth motion before Luca joined her and Elaine and Nynaeve. Birgitta pulled an arrow from the quiver he held, examined it a moment, then tossed it aside like rubbish. Luca frowned and opened his mouth, but she was already discarding a second shaft. The next three went to the leaf-covered ground as well before she stuck one point down in the soil beside her. Of 21, she kept only 4.
"She can do it," Elaine whispered, trying to sound certain.
Nynaeve nodded bleakly. If they had to pay out 100 gold crowns, they would soon be selling the jewelry Amathera had given them. The letters of rights were all but useless, as she had explained to Nynaeve. Their use would eventually point a finger to where they had been for Elida, if not where they were.
"If I had just spoken up in time, I could have stopped this. As my warder, she has to do as I say, doesn't she?"
From the evidence so far, obedience was no part of the bond. Had those Aes Sedai she had spied on made the men give oaths as well? Now that she thought of it, she believed one of them had. Birgitta knocked an arrow, raised the bow, and loosed, seemingly without pausing to aim. Elaine winced, but the steel point struck dead center in the middle of the carved white cross. Before it stopped quivering, the second brushed in beside it. Birgitta did wait a moment then, but only for the two arrows to still. A gasp rose from the onlookers as the third shaft split the first, but that was nothing to the absolute silence, as the last split the other just as neatly. Once could have been chance. Twice. Luca looked as if his eyes were coming out of his head. Mouth hanging open, he stared at the tree, then at Birgitta. At the tree, then Birgitta. She proffered the bow, and he shook his head weakly. Suddenly he flung the quiver away, spreading his arms wide with a glad cry.
"Not knives! Arrows! From 100 paces!"
Nynaeve sagged against Elaine as the man explained what he wanted, but she made not one sound of protest. Tom and Julin were collecting money, most handed over coins with a sigh or a laugh, but Julin had to snag Latel's arm as she tried to slip away and speak some angry words before she dug coins from her pouch. So that was what they had been up to. She would have to speak to them firmly, but later.
"Nana, you don't have to go through with this."
The woman only stared at Birgitta, eyes haggard.
"Our wager?" Birgitta said when Luca ran out of wind.
He grimaced, then fished slowly into his pouch and tossed her a coin. Elaine caught the glint of gold in the sun as Birgitta examined it, then tossed it right back.
The bet was a silver penny on your part.
Luca's eyes widened in startlement, but the next moment he was laughing and pressing the gold crown into her hand.
You are worth every copper of it. What do you say? Why, the Queen of Gildan herself might come to see a performance such as yours. Birgitta and her arrows. We will paint them silver, and the bow.
Desperately, Elaine wanted Birgitta to look at her. They might as well put up a sign for Mogadine as do what the man suggested. But Birgitta only bounced the coin on her hand, grinning.
Paint will ruin an already shabby bow, she said finally.
And call me Marion. I was called that once. Leaning on the bow, she let her smile widen.
Can I have the red dress, too?
Elaine heaved a sigh of fervent relief. Nynaeve looked as if she were going to sick up.
Chapter 37 Performances in Samara. For what seemed the 100th time, Nynaeve held a lock of her hair up to look at it and sighed. Thick murmurs of talk and laughter from hundreds, if not thousands, of throats, distant music that was nearly drowned out, drifted in through the wagon walls. She had not minded spending the parade through the streets of Samara in the wagon with Elaine. Occasional peeks through the windows had convinced her that she would just as soon not be out in those packed crowds, yelling and barely making way for the wagons. But every time she looked at the brassy red of her hair, she wished she had been doing somersaults with the Chavanas, rather than dyeing it. Carefully not looking at herself, she wrapped up completely in her plain dark gray shawl, turned, and gave a start to find Birgitta standing in the doorway. The woman had ridden in Clarine and Petra's wagon during the parade, with Clarine altering a spare red dress she had been making for Nynaeve at Luca's direction. He had given Clarine her instructions before Nynaeve ever agreed. Birgitta wore it now, her black-dyed braid pulled over her shoulder so it nestled between her breasts, totally unconscious of the low, square neck. Just looking at her made Nynaeve fold her shawl tighter. Birgitta could not show a fingernail more of pale bosom and retain the slightest claim to decency. As it was, such a claim would be feeble, really quite laughable. Looking at her made Nynaeve's stomach knot up, but not for reasons of clothes or skin.
"If you are going to wear the dress, why cover up?"
Birgitta came inside and closed the door behind her.
"You are a woman. Why not be proud of it?"
"If you think I shouldn't," Nynaeve replied hesitantly, and slowly let the shawl slide down to her elbows, revealing the twin of the other woman's garment. She felt all but naked.
I thought...
Gripping her silk skirts hard to keep her hands at her sides, she held her gaze on the other woman. Even knowing she wore exactly the same herself, it was easier that way.
Birgitta grimaced.
And if I wanted you to lower the neck another inch?
Nynaeve opened her mouth, face going as scarlet as the gown, but for a moment nothing came out.
When it did, she sounded as if she were being strangled.
"There isn't an inch to lower it. Look at your own. There isn't a tenth."
3 quick, frowning strides, and Birgitta bent slightly to put her face right in Nynaeve's.
"And if I said I wanted you to rid yourself of that inch," she snarled, showing teeth. "What if I wanted to paint your face so Luca could have his fool? What if I stripped you out of it altogether and painted you from head to toe? A fine target you would make then. Every man inside 50 miles would come to see."
Nynaeve's mouth worked, but this time no sound emerged at all. She wanted very much to close her eyes. Maybe when she opened them, none of this would be happening. With a disgusted shake of her head, Birgitta took a seat on one of the beds, one elbow on her knee and her blue eyes sharp.
"This must stop. When I look at you, you flinch. You run about waiting on me hand and foot. If I glance for a stool, you fetch one. If I lick my lips, you have a cup of wine in my hands before I know I am thirsty. You would wash my back and put the slippers on my feet if I let you.
I am neither monster nor invalid nor child, Nynaeve.
I'm only trying to make up for... she began timidly, and jumped when the other woman roared.
Make up? You are trying to make me less!
No, no, it is not that, truly. I am to blame.
You take responsibility for my actions, Birgitta broke in fiercely. I chose to speak to you in Telaranriod. I chose to help you. I chose to track Mogadine. And I chose to take you to see her. Me! Not you, Nynaeve, me! I was not your puppet, your packhound then, and I will not be now.
Nynaeve swallowed hard and gripped her skirts more tightly. She had no right to be angry with this woman. No right at all. But Birgitta had every right.
You did what I asked. It is my fault that you are here. It is all my fault.
Have I mentioned fault? I see none. Only men and dim-witted girls take blame where there is none, and you are neither.
It was my foolish pride that made me think I could best her again, and my cowardice that let her... If I had not been so afraid I could not spit, I might have done something in time.
A coward? Birgitta's eyes widened, openly incredulous, and scorn touched her voice.
You? I thought you had more sense than to confuse fear with cowardice. You could have fled Telaranriod when Mogadine released you, but you stayed to fight. No fault or blame to you that you could not.
Drawing a deep breath, she rubbed her forehead for a moment, then leaned forward intently again.
Listen to me close, Nynaeve. I take no blame for what was done to you. I saw, but I could not twitch. Had Mogadine tied you into a knot or cored you like an apple, still I would take no blame. I did what I could, when I could, and you did the same.
It was not the same, Nynaeve tried to take the heat out of her voice.
It was my fault that you were there. My fault that you are here. If you...
She stopped to swallow again.
If you miss when you shoot at me today, I want you to know that I will understand.
I do not miss where I aim, Birgitta said dryly. And where I aim will not be at you.
She began taking things from one of the cabinets and laying them on the small table. Half-finished arrows, scraped shafts, steel arrow points, stone glue pot, fine cord, gray goose feathers for fletchings. She had said she would make her own bow, too, as soon as she could. Lucas, she called, a knot-riddled branch broken from a cross-grained tree by a blind idiot in the middle of the night.
I liked you, Nynaeve, she said as she laid everything out, thorns, warts, and all. I no longer do as you are now.
You have no reason to like me now, Nynaeve said miserably. But the other woman spoke right over her without looking up.
And I will not allow you to make me less, to make my decisions less by claiming responsibility for them. I have had few women friends, but most have had tempers like snow ghosts.
I wish you could be my friend once more.
What under the light was a snow ghost? Something from another age, no doubt.
I would never try to make you less, Birgitta. I only...
Birgitta paid her no mind, except to raise her voice. Her attention seemed all on her arrow shafts.
I would like to like you again, whether you return the liking or not, but I cannot until you are yourself again. I could live with you a milk-tongued, sniveling wretch, if that was what you were. I take people as they are, not as I would like them to be, or else I leave them. But that is not what you are, and I will not accept your reasons for playing at it. So, Clarine told me of your encounter with Sarandon. Now I know what to do the next time you claim my decisions as your own.
She swished a length of ashwood vigorously.
I am sure Latelle will be happy to provide the switch.
Nynaeve forced her jaws to unclench, forced her tone as smooth as she could make it.
You have a perfect right to do whatever you wish to me.
Her fists in her skirts quivered more than her voice.
A touch of temper showing, just at the edges.
Birgitta grinned at her, at once amused and startlingly feral. How long before it bursts into flame? I'm willing to wear out any number of switches if need be. The grin faded into seriousness. I will make you see the right of this, or I will drive you away. There is no other course. I cannot, will not, leave Elaine. That bond honors me, and I will honor it and her. And I will not allow you to think that you make my decisions or made them. I am myself, not an appendage to you. Now go away. I must finish these arrows if I am to have even a few shafts that will fly true. I do not mean to kill you, and I would not have it happen by accident. Unstopping the glue pot, she bent over the table. Do not forget to curtsy like a good girl on your way out. Nynaeve made it as far as the foot of the steps before pounding her fist on her thigh in a fury. How dare the woman! Did she think that she could just... Did she think that Nynaeve would put up with... I thought she could do anything she wanted to you, a small voice whispered in her head. I said she could kill me, she snarled at it, not humiliate me. Before much longer, everybody would be threatening her with that bloody Shanshan woman. The wagon stood abandoned except for a few rough-coated horse-handlers for guards near the tall, sprawling canvas fence erected to contain Luca's show. From this large brown grass meadow half a mile from Samara, the gray stone walls of the city were clearly visible, with squat towers at the gates, and a few of the taller buildings showing roofs of thatch or tile. Outside the walls, villages of huts and rude shanties sprouted like mushrooms in every direction, full of the prophet's followers, and they had stripped every tree for miles, either for building or for firewood. The show's entrance for patrons was on the other side, but two of the horse handlers with stout cudgels stood on this side to discourage any who did not want to pay from entering as the performers did. Nynaeve was almost upon them, striding as hard as she could and muttering angrily to herself, when their idiotic grins made her realize that the shawl was still looped over her elbows. Her stare wiped their faces blank. Only then did she cover herself properly, and slowly. She was not about to have these louts think they could make her yelp and leap. The skinny one with a nose that took up half of his face held the canvas flap aside, and she ducked through into pandemonium. Everywhere people thronged in noisy milling clusters of men and women and children, in chattering streams flowing from one attraction to the next. All but the Stradit performed on raised wooden stages Luca had had built. Sarandon's boar horses had the largest crowd, the huge gray animals actually balancing on their foreheads, even the baby. Long snouts curved up sinuously, while Clarine's dogs had the smallest, for all they did backsprings and flips over each other's backs. A good many people paused to stare at the lions and the hairy boar-like kapars in their cages, the strangely horned deer from Arafel and Saldea and Aradoman, and the bright birds from the light new where, and some waddling brown-furred creatures with big eyes and round ears that sat placidly eating leaves from branches gripped in their forepaws. Luca's tale on where they came from varied, she supposed he did not know, and he had not been able to make up a name for them that pleased him. A huge snake from the marshes of Ilion, four times as long as a man, earned nearly as many gasps as the Sredit, although simply lying there apparently asleep. But she was pleased to see that Latell's bears, at the moment standing atop huge red wooden balls that they rolled in circles with their feet, attracted few more than the dogs. Bears these people could see in their own forests, even if these did have white faces. Latell sparkled in the afternoon sunlight in her black spangles. Sarandon glittered almost as much in blue, and Clarine in green, though neither had quite as many sequins sewn on as Latell, but every last one of the dresses had a collar right up to the chin. Of course, Petra and the Chavanas were performing attired only in bright blue breeches, but that was to show off their muscles, only understandable. The acrobats were standing one atop the other's shoulders, four high. Not far from them, the strong man took a long bar with a large iron ball at each end,
Two men were needed to hand the thing up to him, and immediately began twirling it in his thick hands, even spinning the bar around his neck and across his back. Tom was juggling fire and eating it as well. Eight flaming batons made a perfect circle, then suddenly he had four in each hand, one sticking up from each cluster. Deftly popping each upraised flaming end into his mouth in turn, he appeared to swallow and took them out extinguished, looking as if he had just had something tasty. Nynaeve could not fathom how he did not scorch his mustaches off, much less burn his throat. A twist of his wrists and the unlit batons folded into the lit like fans. A moment later they were making two interlinked circles above his head. He wore the same brown coat he always did, though Luca had given him a red one sewn with sequins. From the way Tom's bushy eyebrows rose as she stalked past, he did not understand why she glared at him. His own coat, indeed! She hurried on toward the thick, impatiently buzzing crowd circled around the two tall poles with the rope stretched tightly between. She had to use her elbows to reach the front row, though two women did glare and snatch their men out of her way when the shawl slipped. She would have glared back had she not been so busy blushing and covering herself. Luca was there, frowning as anxiously as a husband outside a birthing room, next to a thick fellow who had his head shaved except for a grizzled topknot. She slipped in on the other side of Luca. The shaven-headed man had a villainous look, a long scar sliced down his left cheek, and a patch over that eye was painted with a scowling red replacement. Few of the men she had seen here were armed with more than a belt knife, but he wore a sword strapped to his back, the long hilt rising above his right shoulder. He looked vaguely familiar for some reason, but her mind was all on the high rope. Luca frowned at the shawl, smiled at her, and tried to put an arm around her waist. While he was still trying to catch his breath from her elbow and she was still getting her shawl decently back in place, Julin came staggering out of the crowd on the other side, conical red hat tilted jauntily, coat half off one shoulder, and a wooden mug in his fist slopping over the rim. With the over-careful steps of a man whose head contains more wine than brains, he approached the rope ladder leading up to one of the high platforms and stared at it.
"Go on," someone shouted. "Break your fool neck."
"Wait, friend," Luca called, starting forward with smiles and flourishes of his cloak. "That is no place for a man with a belly full of—" Setting the mug on the ground, Julin scampered up the ladder and stood swaying on the platform. Nynaeve held her breath. The man had a head for heights, and well he should after a life of chasing thieves across the rooftops of Tyr, but still. Julin turned as if lost. He appeared too drunk to see or remember the ladder. His eyes fixed on the rope. Tentatively he put one foot onto the narrow span, then drew it back. Pushing the hat back to scratch his head, he studied the taut rope, and abruptly brightened visibly. Slowly he got down on hands and knees and crawled wobbling out onto the rope. Luca shouted for him to come down, and the crowd roared with laughter. Halfway across, Julin stopped, swaying awkwardly, and peered back, his eyes latching onto the mug he had left on the ground. Plainly he was considering how to get back to it. Slowly, with exceeding care, he stood, facing the way he had come, and wavering from side to side. A gasp rose from the crowd as his foot slipped and he fell, somehow catching himself with one hand and a knee hooked around the rope. Luca caught the Tarabonner hat as it fell, shouting to everyone that the man was mad, and whatever happened was no responsibility of his. Nynaeve pressed both hands tight against her middle. She could imagine being up there, and even that was enough to make her feel ill. The man was a fool, a pure bull-goose fool. With an obvious effort, Julin managed to catch the rope with his other hand and pulled himself along it hand over hand to the far platform. Swaying from side to side, he brushed his coat, tried to pull it straight, and succeeded only in changing which shoulder hung down, and spotted his mug at the floor of the other pole.
Pointing to it gleefully, he stepped out onto the rope again. This time at least half the onlookers shouted for him to go back, shouted that there was a ladder behind him. The others only laughed uproariously, no doubt waiting for him to break his neck. He walked across smoothly, slid down the rope ladder with his hands and feet on the outside, and snatched up the wooden mug to take a deep drink. Not until Luca clapped the red hat on Julin's head and they both bowed, Luca flourishing his cloak in such a way that Julin was behind it half the time, did the watchers realize that it had all been part of the show. A moment of silence, and then they exploded with applause and cheers and laughter. Nynaeve had half thought they might turn ugly after being duped. The fellow with the topknot looked villainous even while laughing. Leaving Julin standing beside the ladder, Luca came back to stand between Nynaeve and the man with the topknot. I thought that would go well. He sounded incredibly self-satisfied, and he made little bows to the crowd as if he had been the one up on the rope. Giving him a sour frown, she had no time to speak the acid comment on her tongue, because Elaine came bounding through the crowd to stand beside Julin, with her arms upraised and one knee bent. Nynaeve's mouth tightened, and she shifted her shawl irritably. Whatever she thought of the red dress that she had found herself wearing without really knowing how, she was not sure that Elaine's costume was not worse. The daughter heir of Andor was all in snow white, with a scattering of white sequins sparkling on her short coat and snug breeches. Nynaeve had not really believed that Elaine would actually appear in the clothes in public, but she had been too concerned over her own attire to give her opinion. The coat and breeches made her think of men. She had never approved of men wearing boys' clothes, but the color and spangles made these even more flagrant. Julin held the rope ladder for Elaine to climb, though there was no need. She went up as adeptly as he could have. He vanished into the crowd as soon as she reached the top, where she posed again, beaming at the thunderous applause as if at the adulation of her subjects. As she stepped out onto the rope, somehow it seemed even thinner than when Julin had been on it, Nynaeve all but ceased breathing, and she stopped thinking of Elaine's clothes or her own at all. Elaine made her way out onto the rope, arms outstretched to either side, and she was not channeling a platform of air. Slowly she stepped her way across, one foot in front of the other, never wavering, supported only by the rope. Channeling would be far too dangerous if Mogadin had even a clue to where they were. The Forsaken or Black Sisters could be in Samara, and they would be able to feel the weave. And if they were not in Samara now, they might be soon. On the far platform, Elaine paused to considerably more applause than Julin had received. Nynaeve could not understand that, and started back. Almost to the end, she pivoted smoothly, walked back halfway, pivoted again, and wobbled, just catching herself. Nynaeve felt as though a hand had her by the throat. At a slow, steady pace, Elaine high-walked to the platform, once more posing to thunderous shouts and clapping. Nynaeve swallowed her heart and breathed again, raggedly, but she knew it was not over. Raising her hands above her head, Elaine suddenly cartwheeled herself along the rope, black tresses whipping, white-sheathed legs flashing in the sun. Nynaeve yelped and clutched Luca's arm as the girl reached the far platform, stumbled in landing, and caught herself just short of going over the edge. "What's the matter?" he murmured beneath the gasp rising from the crowd. "You've seen her do this every evening since Sienda, and a good many other places, too, I would think." "Of course," she said weakly. Eyes fixed on Elaine, she barely noticed the arm he slipped around her shoulders, certainly not enough to do anything about it. She had tried to talk the girl into feigning a sprained ankle, but Elaine insisted that after all of that practice with the power, she did not need it now. Maybe Julin did not. Apparently he did not. But Elaine had never gone scrambling over rooftops in the night. The return cartwheels went perfectly, and the landing, but Nynaeve did not look away or loose her hold on Luca's sleeve. After what now seemed the inevitable pause for applause, Elaine returned to the rope for more pivots, one leg raised and whipping down and up so quickly that it seemed she kept it outstretched the whole while.
and for a slow handstand that lifted her straight as a dagger, white-slippered toes pointed to the sky, and a backflip that had the crowd gasping and her swaying from side to side, only just catching her balance. Tom Marilyn had taught her that, and the handstand. From the corner of her eye, Nynaeve caught Tom, two places down from her, eyes riveted to Elaine, poised on the balls of his feet. He looked as proud as a peacock. He looked ready to rush forward and catch her if she fell. If she did fall, it would be at least partly his fault. He should never have taught her those things. One last passage of cartwheels, white legs flashing and glittering in the sun faster than before. A passage that had never been mentioned to Nynaeve. She would have eviscerated Luca with her tongue had he not muttered angrily that Elaine adding to the act just for applause was a good way to break her neck. One last pause to pose for more of that applause, and Elaine at last climbed down. Shouting, the crowd rushed in on her. Luca and four horse handlers with cudgels appeared around her as if by the power, but even so, Tom beat them to her, limp and all. Nynaeve jumped as high as she could, just managing to see over enough heads to make out Elaine. The girl did not seem frightened or even taken aback by all the waving hands trying to touch her, stretching between her encircling guards. Head high, face flushed from effort, she still managed a cool and regal grace as she was escorted away. How she could do that, garbed as she was, Nynaeve simply could not imagine.
"Face like a bloody queen,"
the one-eyed man muttered to himself. He had not gone running with the others, but merely let them stream past. Roughly dressed in a plain coat of dark gray wool, he certainly looked solid enough to have no fears of being knocked down and trampled. He appeared as if he could use that sword.
"Burn me for a sheep-gutted farmer, but she's flaming well brave enough for a bloody queen."
Nynaeve gaped at him as he strode away through the crowd, and it was not his language, or rather it was, partly. Now she remembered where she had seen him, a one-eyed man with a topknot who could not say two sentences without the vilest curses. Forgetting about Elaine, she was certainly safe enough, Nynaeve began pushing her way through the throng after him. Chapter 38 An Old Acquaintance. With the crowds, it took Nynaeve some little time to catch up, muttering every time she was jostled by a man gaping at everything in sight, or a woman dragging a child with either hand, children usually trying to drag her to two different attractions at once. The one-eyed man barely paused to look at anything except the big snake and the lions until he reached the boar horses. He had to have seen them earlier, situated as they were near the patron's entrance. Every time the Sredit stood on their hind legs, as they were doing now, the great tusked heads of the adults could be seen by those outside the canvas fence, and the press to enter intensified a little more. Beneath a wide red sign that said Velan Luca in ornate gold script on both sides, two of the horse handlers collected admission from people funneled between two thick ropes, taking the money in clear, blown-glass pitchers, both thick and flawed. Luca would never lay out coin for better, so they could see that the coins were right without touching them. They dumped the money straight from the pitchers through a hole in the top of an iron-strapped box so wrapped about with chain that Petra had to have put it in place before the first silver penny went in. Another pair of horse handlers, thick-shouldered, broken-nosed men with the sunken knuckles of brawlers, stood nearby with cudgels to make sure that the crowd remained orderly. And to keep an eye on the men taking the money, Nynaeve suspected. Luca was not a trusting man, especially when it came to coin. In fact, he was as tight as the skin on an apple. She had never met anyone so stingy. Slowly, she elbowed close to the man with the gray-streaked topknot. He had had no trouble reaching the front rank before the Sredit, of course. His scar and painted eye patch would have seen to that, even without the sword on his back. At the moment, he was watching the big gray animals with a grin and what she supposed was wonder on that stony face. Uno? She thought that was the right name. His head turned to stare at her.
Once she had the shawl back in place, he raised the stare to her face, but no recognition lit in his dark eye. The other, the painted red glaring one, made her a little queasy. Sarandon waved her goad, shouting something slurred beyond intelligibility, and the Sredit turned, Sanit the cow placing her feet on Mare's broad, rounded back, while he remained upright. Naren the calf put her feet low on Sanit's back.
"I saw you in Faldara," Nynaeve said, "and again on Tomon Head, briefly, after Falma. You were with—"
She did not know how much she could say with people cheek by jowl around her. Rumors of the Dragon Reborn had circulated all through Amadicia, and some even had his name right. With Rand. Uno's real eye narrowed. She tried not to see the other, and after a moment he nodded.
I remember the face. I never forget a flaming pretty face. But the hair was bloody well different.
Nina? Nynaeve, she told him sharply. He shook his head, eyeing her up and down, and before she could say another word, he had seized her arm and was all but dragging her through the entrance. The horse handlers there recognized her, of course, and the broken-nosed fellows started forward, hefting their cudgels. She waved them away furiously, even as she was yanking her arm free. It took three tries, and still it was more a matter of his letting go. The man had a grip like iron. The men with the clubs hesitated, then drifted back to their places when they saw Uno drop his grip. Apparently they knew what Valen Luca would prefer them to be guarding.
"What do you think you are doing?"
she demanded. But Uno only mentioned her to follow, watching to see that she did so without more than slowing his stride through the crowd waiting to get in. He had slightly bowed legs and moved like a man more used to the back of a horse than his own feet. Growling to herself, she picked up her skirts and stalked after him toward the town. Two other menageries were set up behind brown canvas walls not far off, and beyond them more lay scattered among the crowded shanty villages. None too close to the city walls, though. Apparently the governor, as they called the woman Nynaeve could have named mayor, though she had never heard of a woman mayor, had decreed half a mile as the distance, to protect the town in case any of the animals got loose. The sign over the entrance to the nearest show said Maren Gome in florid green and gold. Two women were clearly visible above the sign, clinging to a rope hanging from a tall framework of poles that had not been there when Luca's walls went up. Apparently the boar horses rearing high enough to be seen was having an effect. The women contorted themselves into positions that made Nynaeve think uncomfortably of what Mogadine had done, and somehow even managed to hold themselves out in horizontal handstands to either side of the rope. The crowd, waiting impatiently in front of Mistress Gome's sign, was almost as large as the one in front of Luca's. None of the other shows had anything visible that she could see, and their crowds were much smaller. Uno refused to answer her questions or say a word or do more than give her dire frowns until they were out of the jam of people and onto a cart path of hard-packed dirt.
"What I am flaming trying to do," he growled then, "is to take you where we can flaming well talk without you being torn to flaming bits by flaming folk trying to kiss your flaming hem when they find out you flaming know the Lord Dragon."
There was no one within 30 paces of them, but he still stared around for anyone who might hear.
"Blood and bloody ashes, woman! Don't you know what these flaming goat-heads are like? Half of them think the Creator talks to him over bloody supper every night, and the other half think he is the bloody Creator."
"I will thank you to moderate your language, Master Uno. And I will thank you to slow down, too. We are not running a foot race. Where are you going, and why should I stir another step with you?"
He rolled his eye toward her, chuckling wryly. "Oh, I do remember you. The one with the mouth. Regan thought you could skin and butcher a bull at 10 paces with your tongue. Jaina and Nangu thought 50.
At least he did shorten his stride. Nynaeve stopped dead.
"Where and why?" "Into the town."
He did not stop. He strode right on, flipping a hand for her to follow.
"I don't know what you're doing here, but I remember you were mixed up with that blue woman."
Snarling under her breath, she gathered her skirts and hurried after him again. It was the only way to hear. He continued as if she had been beside him the whole time.
"This is no blood, no place for you to be. I can scrape together enough blood. Ah! Enough coin to get you to Tyr, I think. Rumor says that's where the Lord Dragon is." Again, he looked around warily. "Unless you want to go to the island instead."
He must have meant Tar Valon.
There's odd rumors floating around about that, too. Peace, if there aren't.
He came from a land that had not known peace in 3,000 years. Shinarans used the word as talisman and oath both.
"They say the old Amarlin's been deposed. Executed, maybe. Some say they fought and burned the whole..."
He paused, taking a deep breath and grimacing horribly. "The whole city." Walking along, she studied him in amazement. She had not seen him in nearly a year, had never spoken more than two words together to him, and yet he... Why did men always think a woman needed a man to look after her? Men could not lace up their own shirts without a woman to help. "We are doing quite well as we are, thank you. Unless you know when a river trader will dock on his way downriver."
"We? Is the blue woman with you, or the brown?"
That had to be Moiraine and Verin. He was certainly being cautious. "No. Do you remember Elaine?" He gave a blunt nod, and a mischievous impulse seized her. Nothing seemed to faze the man, and he obviously expected to just take charge of her welfare. "You saw her again just now. You said she had a..." She made her voice gruff in imitation of his.
"Face like a bloody queen."
He stumbled in a quite satisfactory way, and glared around him so fiercely that even two white cloaks riding by skirted wide around him, though they tried to pretend he had nothing to do with it, of course.
"Her?" he growled incredulously. "But her bloody hair was black as a raven's."
He glanced at hers, and the next minute he was pacing up the cart path again, muttering half to himself,
"The flaming woman is daughter to a queen, a bloody queen, showing her bloody legs that way."
Nynaeve nodded in agreement, until he said,
"You bloody Southlanders are bloody strange. No flaming decency at all."
He had fine room to talk. Shinarans might dress properly, but she still blushed to remember that in Shinar, men and women bathed together as often as not, and thought no more of it than of eating together.
"Did your mother never teach you to talk decently, man?"
His real eye frowned at her almost as darkly as the painted one, and he rolled his shoulders. In Faldara, he and everyone else had treated her as nobly born, or the next thing, too. Of course, it was hard to pass herself off as a lady in that dress, and with her hair a shade that nature never made. She arranged her shawl more snugly and folded her arms to hold it in place. The gray wool was terribly uncomfortable in that dry heat, and she herself was not feeling very dry at all. She had never heard of anyone who died sweating, but she thought she might well be the first. "What are you doing here, Uno?" He looked around before answering. Not that he had need. There was little traffic on the path, an occasional ox-drawn cart, a few folk in farm clothes or rougher, here and there a man on a horse, and no one seemed willing to come any closer to him than they had to. He appeared a man who might cut somebody's throat on a whim.
"The blue woman gave us a name in Johanna, and said we were to wait there until she sent instructions. But the woman in Johanna was dead and buried when we arrived. An old woman, died in her sleep, and none of her relatives had ever heard the blue woman's name. Then Massima started talking to people, and, well, there was no point staying there for orders we'd never hear if they did come. We stay close to Massima because he slips us enough to live on, though none except Bartu and Nengar listen to his trash."
The grizzled topknot swung as he shook his head in irritation. Suddenly Nynaeve realized that there had not been a single obscene word in that. He looked about to swallow his tongue. "Perhaps if you cursed only occasionally," she sighed.
"Maybe once every other sentence."
The man smiled at her so gratefully that she wanted to throw up her hands in exasperation.
How is it that Massima has money when the rest of you do not?
She remembered Massima, a dark, sour man who liked no one and nothing.
Why, he's the bloody prophet they've all come to hear. Would you like to meet him?
He gave the impression of counting his sentences. Nynaeve breathed deeply. The man was going to take her literally.
He might find you a flaming boat if you want one. In Gildan, what the prophet wants, the prophet usually gets. No, he always flaming gets it in the end, one way or another. The man was a good soldier, but who'd have ever thought he would turn out like this?
His frown took in all the rude villages and the people, even the shows and the city ahead. Nynaeve hesitated. The dreaded prophet, rousing mobs and riots, was Massima? But he did preach the coming of the Dragon Reborn. They were almost to the town gate, and there was time yet before she must stand up and let Birgitta shoot arrows at her. Luca had been more than disappointed that the woman insisted on being called Marion. If Massima could find a boat heading downriver, today maybe. On the other hand, there were the riots. If rumor inflated them tenfold, then only hundreds had died in towns and cities farther north. Only hundreds.
Just don't remind him that you have anything to do with that bloody island, Uno went on, eyeing her thoughtfully.
Now that she thought of it, she realized that he very likely did not know what her connection to Tar Valon actually was. Women did go there without becoming Aes Sedai, after all, to seek help or answers. He was aware that she was involved in some way, but no more than that.
He isn't much friendlier to women from there than the white cloaks are. If you just keep your mouth bloody well shut about it, he'll likely pass it over. For somebody who comes from the same village as the Lord Dragon, Massima will probably have a flaming boat built.
The crowds were thicker at the city gates, flanked by squat grey towers, men and women streaming in and out, afoot and mounted, in every sort of garb from rags to embroidered silk coats and dresses. The gates themselves, thick and iron-bound, stood open under the guard of a dozen spearmen in scaled tunics and round steel caps with flat rims. Actually, the guards paid more attention to half their number of white cloaks lounging nearby than to anything else. It was the men in snowy cloaks and burnished mail who watched the flow of people.
"Do the white cloaks cause much trouble?" she asked quietly.
Uno pursed his lips as if to spit, glanced at her, and did not.
"Where do they bloody not? There was a woman with one of these traveling shows who did tricks, sleight of hand. 4 days ago, a flaming mob of pigeon-gutted sheepheads tore the show apart."
Valen Luca had certainly never mentioned that.
"Peace. What they wanted was the woman. Claimed she was..."
He glowered at the folk hurrying by and lowered his voice.
"Aes Sedai. And a dark friend. Broke her bloody neck getting her to a rope, so I hear, but they hung her corpse anyway. Massima had the ringleaders beheaded, but it was white cloaks whipped up the bloody mob."
His scowl matched the red eye painted on his patch.
"There's been too many flaming hangings and beheadings, if you bloody well ask me. Bloody Massima's as bad as the bloody white cloaks when it comes to finding a dark friend under every flaming rock."
"Once every other sentence," she murmured, and the man actually blushed.
"Don't know what I'm thinking," he grumped, coming to a stop. "Can't take you in there. It's half festival and half riot, with a cut purse every third step and a woman not safe out of doors after dark."
He sounded more scandalized about the last than the rest. In Shinar, a woman was safe anywhere, any time, except from Trollocs and Murdral, of course, and any man would die to see it so.
"Not safe. I'll take you back. When I find a way, I'll come for you."
That settled it for her. Pulling her arm loose before he could get a grip on it, she quickened her pace toward the gates.
"Come along, Uno, and do not dawdle. If you dawdle, I will leave you behind."
He caught up to her, grumbling under his breath about the stubbornness of women. Once she understood that that was his subject, and that apparently he did not think her injunction against cursing held when talking to himself, she stopped listening.
Chapter 39 Encounters in Samara. The white cloaks at the gates gave Uno and Nynaeve no more mind than they gave anyone else in the steady throng, which was to say a cold, suspicious stare, searching yet quick.
Too many people made anything else impossible, and maybe the scale-armored guards did, too. Not that there was any reason for more, except in her mind. Her great serpent ring and Lan's heavy gold ring both nestled in her pouch. The dress's low neckline meant she could not wear them on the thong, but somehow she almost expected Children of the Light to pick out a tower-trained woman by instinct. Her relief was palpable when those icy, unfeeling eyes swept past her. The soldiers paid the two of them as little attention once she rearranged her shawl yet again. Uno's scowl might have helped send their eyes back to the white cloaks, but the man had no right to scowl in the first place. It was her business. Rewrapping the folded length of gray wool one more time, she tied the ends around her waist. The shawl defined her bosom more than she wished, and still exposed a bit of cleavage, yet it was a considerable improvement on the dress alone. At least she would not have to worry about the shawl slipping again. If only the thing were not so hot. The weather really should be turning soon. They were not that far south of the two rivers. Uno patiently waited on her for a change. She was of two minds as to whether this was simple courtesy. His scarred face looked a deal too patient. But finally they walked together into Samara, into chaos. A babble of noise hung over everything, no one sound distinguishable. People jammed the rough stone-paved streets all but shoulder to shoulder from slate-roofed taverns to thatch-roofed stables, from raucous inns with simple painted signs like the Blue Bull or the Dancing Goose, to shops where the signs had no words, only a knife and scissors here, a bolt of cloth there, a goldsmith's scales or a barber's razor, a pot or a lamp or a boot. Nynaeve saw faces as pale as that of any Andorman, and as dark as that of any of the sea folk, some clean, some dirty, and coats with high collars, low collars, no collars, drably colored and bright, plain and embroidered, shabby and near new made, in styles strange as often as familiar. One fellow with a dark forked beard wore silver chains across the chest of his plain blue coat, and two with their hair in braids, men, with a black braid over each ear below their shoulders, had tiny brass bells sewn to their red coat sleeves and the turned-down tops of thigh-high boots. Whatever land they hailed from, those two were not fools. Their dark eyes were hard and searching as Uno's, and they carried curved swords on their backs. A bare-chested man in a bright yellow sash, skin a deeper brown than aged wood, and hands intricately tattooed, had to be one of the sea folk, though he wore neither earrings nor nose ring. The women were equally as diverse, hair ranging from raven black to yellow so pale it was nearly white, braided or gathered or hanging loose, cut short, to the shoulders, to the waist, dresses in worn wool or neat linen or shimmering silk, collars brushing chins with lace or embroidery, and necklines every bit as low as the one she hid. She even saw a copper-complexioned Damani woman in a barely opaque red gown that covered her to the neck and hid next to nothing. She wondered how safe that woman would be after dark, or in this broad daylight, for that matter. The occasional white cloaks and soldiers in that milling mass seemed overwhelmed, struggling to make ground as hard as anyone else. Ox carts and horse-drawn wagons inched along the haphazardly crisscrossing streets. Bearers jostled sedan chairs through the crowds, and now and then a lacquered coach with a plumed team of four or six made its laborious way, liveried footmen and steel-capped guards vainly trying to clear a path. Musicians with flute or zither or bittern played at every corner where there was not a juggler or an acrobat, their skills certainly nothing to make Tom or the Chavanas worry, always with another man or woman holding out a cap for coins. Ragged beggars wove through it all, plucking at sleeves and proffering grimy hands, and hawkers bustled with trays of everything from pins to ribbons to pears, their cries lost in the din. Her head spun by the time Uno drew her into a narrower street where the throng seemed thinner, if only by comparison. She paused to straighten her clothes, disarrayed from plunging through the crowd, before following him. It was a trifle quieter here, too. No street entertainers and fewer hawkers and beggars. Beggars kept clear of Uno, even after he tossed a few coppers to a wary pack of urchins, for which she did not blame them. The man just did not look charitable.
The town's buildings loomed over these narrow ways, despite being only two or three stories, putting the streets themselves in shadow. But there was good light in the sky, hours yet till dusk. Still plenty of time to get back to the show, if she had to. With luck, they could all be boarding a riverboat by sunset. She gave a start when another Shinaran suddenly joined them, sword on his back and head shaven but for that topknot, a dark-haired man only a few years older than she. Uno gave curt introductions and explanation without slowing.
"Peace favor you, Nynaeve," Rhaegan said, the skin of his dark cheek dimpling around a triangular white scar. Even smiling, his face was hard. She had never met a soft Shinaran. Soft men did not survive along the Blight, nor soft women either.
"I remember you. Your hair was different, was it not? No matter. Never fear. We will see you safely to Massima, and to wherever you would go after. Just be sure not to mention Tar Valon to him." No one was sparing them a second glance, but he lowered his voice anyway. "Massima thinks the tower will try to control the Lord Dragon." Nynaeve shook her head. Another fool man who was going to take care of her. At least he did not try to engage her in conversation. The mood she was in, she would have given him the rough side of her tongue if he so much as commented on the heat. Her own face felt a trifle damp, and no wonder, having to wear a shawl in this weather. Abruptly, she remembered what the one-eyed man had said concerning Rhaegan's opinion of her tongue. She did not think she more than glanced at him, but Rhaegan moved to the other side of Uno as if for shelter, and eyed her warily. Men. The streets grew still narrower, and though the stone buildings lining them did not grow smaller, it was more often than not the backs of the buildings they saw, and rough gray walls that could hide only small yards. Eventually they turned down an alley barely wide enough for all three of them abreast. At the far end, a lacquered and gilded coach stood surrounded by scale-armored men. More immediately, halfway between her and the coach, fellows lounged thickly along both sides of the alley. In a motley of coats, most clutched clubs or spears or swords as different as their garb. They could have been a pack of street toughs, but neither of the Shinarans slowed, so she did not either.
"The street out front will be full of bloody fools hoping to catch a glimpse of Massima at a bloody window."
Uno's voice was pitched for her ears alone. "The only way to get in is by the back." He fell silent as they came close enough for the waiting men to hear. Two of those were soldiers with rimmed steel helmets and scaled tunics, swords at hip and spears in hand, but it was the others who studied the three newcomers and fingered their weapons. They had disturbing eyes, too intent, almost feverish. For once she would have been pleased to see an honest leer. These men did not care whether she was a woman or a horse. Without a word, Uno and Rhaegan unfastened the scabbarded blades from their backs and handed them and their daggers to a plump-faced man who might have been a shopkeeper once, from the look of his blue woolen coat and breeches. The clothing had been good. It was clean, but heavily worn and wrinkled as if it had been slept in for a month. Plainly he recognized the Shinarans, and though he frowned at her for a moment, especially at her belt knife, he silently nodded to a narrow wooden gate in the stone wall. That was perhaps the most off-putting fact of all. None of them made a sound. On the other side of the wall was a small yard where weeds stuck up between cobblestones. The tall stone house, three broad pale-gray stories, with wide windows and scroll-worked eaves and gables, roofed in dark red tiles, must have been one of the finest in Samara. Once the gate was closed behind them, Rhaegan spoke softly. "There have been attempts to kill the Prophet." It took Nynaeve a moment to realize that he was explaining why their weapons had been taken. "But you are his friends," she protested. "You all followed Rand to Falma together." She was not about to start calling him the Lord Dragon.
"That's why we're bloody let in at all," Uno said dryly. "I told you we don't see everything the way the Prophet does."
The slight pause and the quick half-glance back at the gate to see if anyone was listening spoke volumes. It had been Massima before, and Uno was clearly a man who did not temper his tongue easily.
"Just watch what you say for once," Rhaegan told her, "and likely you will get the help you want."
She nodded, as agreeably as anyone could wish. She knew sense when she heard it, even if he had no right to offer it, and he and Uno exchanged doubtful glances. She was going to stuff these two into a sack with Tom and Julin and switch anything that stuck up. Fine house as it may be, the kitchen was dusty, and empty except for one bony gray-haired woman, her drab gray dress and white apron the only clean things in sight as they walked through. Sucking her teeth, the old woman hardly glanced up from stirring a small kettle of soup over a tiny blaze in one of the wide stone fireplaces. Two battered pots hung on hooks, where 20 could have, and a cracked pottery bowl on a blue lacquered tray stood on the broad table. Beyond the kitchen, moderately fine hangings decorated the walls. Nynaeve had developed something of an eye in the last year, and these scenes of feasts and hunts for deer and bear and boar were only good, not excellent. Chairs and tables and chests lined the halls, dark lacquer streaked with red, inlaid with mother-of-pearl. Hangings and furniture alike were also dusty, and the red and white tiled floor had had only a half-hearted lick with a broom. Cobwebs decorated the corners and cornices of the high plaster ceiling. There were no other servants, or anyone else, in sight, until they came to a weedy fellow sitting on the floor beside an open door, his grimy red silk coat much too large for him, and at odds with a filthy shirt and worn woolen breeches. One of his cracked boots had a large hole in the sole, a toe poked through another in the other one. He held up a hand, whispering, "The light shine on you, and praise the name of the Lord Dragon?" He made it sound a question, querulously twisting a narrow face as unwashed as his shirt, but then he did the same with everything. "The prophet can't be disturbed now? He's busy? You'll have to wait a bit?" Uno nodded patiently, and Regan leaned against the wall. They had been through this before. Nynaeve did not know what she had expected of the prophet, not even now that she was aware who he was, but certainly not filth. That soup had smelled like cabbage and potatoes, hardly the fare for a man who had an entire city dancing for him, and only two servants, both of whom could well have come from the rudest huts outside the city. The skinny guard, if such he was, he had no weapon, perhaps he was not trusted either, seemed to have no objection when she moved to where she could see through the doorway. The man and woman inside could not have been more different. Massima had shaved even his topknot, and his coat was plain brown wool, heavily wrinkled but clean, although his knee-high boots were scuffed. Deep-set eyes turned his permanently sour look to a scowl, and a scar made a pale triangle on his dark cheek, a near mirror image of Regan's, only more faded with age and a hair nearer the eye. The woman, in elegantly gold-embroidered blue silk, was short of her middle years and quite lovely, despite a nose perhaps too long for beauty. A simple blue net cap gathered dark hair spilling almost to her waist, but she wore a broad necklace of gold and firedrops with a matching bracelet, and gemmed rings decorated nearly every finger. Where Massima seemed poised to rush at something, teeth bared, she bore herself with stately reserve and grace. "So many follow wherever you go," she was saying, "that order flies over the wall when you arrive. People are not safe in themselves or their property. The Lord Dragon has broken all bonds of law, all bonds made by mortal men and women." Massima's voice was heated, but intense, not angry. "The prophecies say that the Lord Dragon will break all chains that bind, and it is so. The Lord Dragon's radiance will protect us against the shadow."
"It is not the shadow that threatens here, but cut-purses and slip-fingers and head-crackers. Some who follow you, many, believe that they can take what they wish from whoever has it without payment or leave."
"There is justice in the hereafter, when we are born again. Concern with things of this world is useless. But very well. If you wish earthly justice," his lip curled contemptuously, "let it be this. Henceforth, a man who steals will have his right hand cut off. A man who interferes with a woman or insults her honor or commits murder will be hung. A woman who steals or commits murder will be flogged. If any accuses and finds 12 who will agree, it will be done. Let it be so."
"As you say, of course," the woman murmured. Aloof elegance remained on her face, but she sounded shaken. Nynaeve did not know how Gil'danin law ran, but she did not think it could be so casual as that. The woman took a deep breath. "There is still the matter of food. It becomes difficult to feed so many."
"Every man, woman, and child who has come to the Lord Dragon must have a full belly. It must be so. Where gold can be found, food can be found, and there is too much gold in the world. Too much concern with gold."
Massima's head swung angrily. Not angry with her, but in general. He looked to be searching for those who concerned themselves with gold so he could unleash fury on their heads.
"The Lord Dragon has been reborn. The shadow hangs over the world, and only the Lord Dragon can save us. Only belief in the Lord Dragon, submission and obedience to the word of the Lord Dragon. All else is useless, even where it is not blasphemy."
"Blessed be the name of the Lord Dragon in the light." It had the sound of a rote reply. "It is no longer simply a matter of gold, my Lord Prophet. Finding and transporting food in sufficient—"
"I am not a lord," he broke in again, and now he was angry. He leaned toward the woman, spittle on his lips, and though her face did not change, her hands twitched as if they wanted to clutch her dress. "There is no lord but the Lord Dragon in whom the light dwells, and I am but one humble voice of the Lord Dragon. Remember that. High or low, blasphemers earn the scourge."
"Forgive me," the begemmed woman murmured, spreading her skirts in a curtsy fit for a queen's court. "It is as you say, of course. There is no lord save the Lord Dragon, and I am but a humble follower of the Lord Dragon, blessed be the name of the Lord Dragon, who comes to hear the wisdom and guidance of the prophet."
Wiping his mouth with the back of his hand, Massima was suddenly cold.
"You wear too much gold. Do not let earthly possessions seduce you. Gold is dross. The Lord Dragon is all."
Immediately she began plucking rings from her fingers, and before the second was off, the weedy fellow scurried to her side, pulling a pouch from his coat pocket and holding it for her to drop them in. The bracelet and necklace followed as well. Nynaeve looked at Uno and raised an eyebrow.
"Every penny goes to the poor," he told her in a low voice that barely reached her ear. "Or somebody who needs it. If some merchant hadn't bloody given him her house, he'd be in a bloody stable, or one of those huts outside the city." "Even his food comes as a gift," Rhaegan said just as quietly. "They used to bring him dishes fit for a king, until they learned he just gave away everything but a little bread and soup or stew. He hardly drinks wine now."
Nynaeve shook her head. She supposed it was one way to find money for the poor. Simply rob anyone who was not poor. Of course, that would just make everyone poor in the end, but it might work for a time. She wondered if Uno and Rhaegan knew the whole of it. People who claimed they were collecting money to help others often had a way of letting a good bit stick in their own pockets, or else they liked the power that spreading it about gave them, liked it far too much. She had better feeling for the man who freely gave one copper from his own purse than for the fellow who wrested a gold crown from someone else's, and less for fools who abandoned their farms and shops to follow this prophet, with no idea where their next meal would come from. Inside the room, the woman curtsied to Massima even more deeply than before, spreading her skirts wide and bowing her head.
"Until I once again have the honor of the prophet's words and counsel, the name of the Lord Dragon be blessed in the light."
Massima waved her away absently, already half forgotten. He had seen them in the hall, and was looking at them with as close to pleasure as his dour face could come. It was not very close. The woman swept out, not even appearing to see Nynaeve or the two men. Nynaeve sniffed as the weedy fellow in the red coat waved anxiously for them to come in. For someone who had just given up her jewelry on demand, that woman managed a fine queenly air. The skinny man scampered back to his place by the door as the other three men shook hands in the Borderlands fashion, gripping forearms.
"Peace favor your sword," Uno said, echoed by Rhaegan. "Peace favor the Lord Dragon," was the reply, "and his light illumine us all."
Nynaeve's breath caught. There was no doubt of his meaning.
The Lord Dragon was the source of the light, and he had the nerve to speak of blasphemy from others.
Have you come to the light at last?
We walk in the light, Reagan said carefully, as always.
Uno kept silent, his face blank.
Weary patience made an odd play on Massima's sour features.
There is no way to the light save through the Lord Dragon. You will see the way and the truth in the end, for you have seen the Lord Dragon, and only those whose souls are swallowed in the shadow can see and not believe. You are not such. You will believe.
In spite of the heat and the wool shawl, goosebumps crawled along Nynaeve's arms. Total conviction filled the man's voice, and this close she could see a glint in his nearly black eyes that bordered on madness. He swept those eyes over her, and she stiffened her knees. He made the most rabid white cloak she had ever seen appear mild. Those fellows in the alley were only a pale imitation of their master.
You, woman, are you ready to come to the light of the Lord Dragon, abandoning sin and flesh?
I walk in the light as best I can. She was irritated to find herself speaking as carefully as Reagan.
Sin? Who did he think he was? You are too concerned with the flesh.
Massima's gaze was withering as it swept over her red dress and the shawl wrapped tightly around her.
And what do you mean by that?
Uno's eye widened in startlement, and Reagan made small shushing motions, yet she could as soon have flown as stopped.
Do you think you have a right to tell me how to dress?
Before she quite realized what she was doing, she had untied the shawl and looped it over her elbows. It really was much too hot anyway.
No man has that right, for me or any other woman. If I chose to go naked, it would be none of your concern.
Massima contemplated her bosom for a moment. Not so much as a hint of admiration lit his deep eyes, only acid contempt, then raised that stare to her face. Uno's real eye and painted made a perfect match, scowling at nothing, and Reagan winced, surely muttering to himself inside his head.
Nynaeve swallowed hard, so much for guarding her tongue, for perhaps the first time in her life she truly regretted speaking her mind without thinking first. If this man could order men's hands cut off, order men hung, with only a jackfool excuse of a trial, what was he not capable of? She thought she was angry enough to channel. But if she did, if Mogadine or any black sisters were in Samara, but if I don't?
She wanted very much to wrap the shawl back around her up to her chin, but not with him staring at her. Something in the back of her mind shouted at her not to be a complete woolhead. Only men let pride overcome sense. But she met Massima's gaze defiantly, even if she did have to stop herself from swallowing again. His lip curled.
Such garments are worn to entice men, and for no other reason.
She could not understand how his voice could be so fervent and so icy at the same time.
Thoughts of the flesh distract the mind from the Lord Dragon and the light. I have considered banning dresses that distract men's eyes and minds. Let women who would waste time in attracting men, and men who would attract women, be scourged, until they know that only in perfect contemplation of the Lord Dragon and the light can joy be found.
He was not really looking at her any longer. That dark, burning stare looked through her, to something distant.
Let taverns and places that sell strong drink and all places that would take the minds of people from that perfect contemplation be closed and burned to the ground. I frequented such places in my days of sin, but now I heartily regret, as all should regret their transgressions. There is only the Lord Dragon and the light. All else is illusion, a snare set by the shadow.
This is Nynaeve Almira, Uno said quickly into the first pause for breath. From Emmons Field in the Two Rivers whence the Lord Dragon comes.
Massima's head turned slowly to the one-eyed man, and she hastily took the opportunity to redo the shawl as she had had it.
She was at Faldara with the Lord Dragon, and at Falma. The Lord Dragon rescued her at Falma. The Lord Dragon cares for her as for a mother.
Another time she would have given him a few choice words and maybe a well-boxed ear. Rand had not rescued her. Or not exactly, anyway. And she was only a handful of years older than he. A mother, indeed.
Massima turned back to her. The zealous light that had burned in his eyes before was nothing to what was there now. They almost glowed.
Nynaeve.
Yes.
His voice quickened.
Yes, I remember your name and your face. Blessed are you among women, Nynaeve Almira, none more so save the blessed mother of the Lord Dragon herself, for you watched the Lord Dragon grow. You attended the Lord Dragon as a child.
He seized her arms, hard fingers biting in painfully, but he seemed unaware of it.
You will speak to the crowds of the Lord Dragon's boyhood, of his first words of wisdom, of the miracles that accompanied him. The light has sent you here to serve the Lord Dragon.
She was not exactly sure what to say. There had never been any miracles around Rand that she had seen. She had heard of things in Tyr, but you could hardly call what a Ta'veren caused miracles. Not really. Even what had occurred at Falma had a rational explanation. Sort of. And as for words of wisdom, the first she had heard out of him had been a fervent promise never to throw a rock at anyone again, offered after she had paddled his young backside for it. She did not believe she had heard another word since that she could call wise. In any case, if Rand had given sage advice from his cradle, if there had been comets by night and apparitions in the sky by day, she still would not have stayed with this madman.
"I must travel downriver," she said guardedly, "to join him, the Lord Dragon."
That name curdled on her tongue so soon after her promise to herself, but Rand was apparently never anything as simple as he around the Prophet.
"I am just being sensible. That's all it is. A man is an oak, a woman a willow," the saying ran. "The oak fought the wind and was broken, while the willow bent when it must and survived." That did not mean she had to like bending. The Lord Dragon, is in Tyr. The Lord Dragon has summoned me there.
Tyr.
Massima took his hands away and she surreptitiously rubbed her arms. She did not have to try hiding it, though. He was staring at something beyond sight again.
"Yes, I have heard."
Speaking to something beyond sight, too, or to himself.
"When Amadisia has come to the Lord Dragon, as Gildan has, I will lead the people to Tyr, to bask in the radiance of the Lord Dragon. I will send disciples to spread the word of the Lord Dragon throughout Tarabon and Arad-Doman, to Saldea and Kandor and the borderlands, to Andor, and I will lead the people to kneel at the Lord Dragon's feet."
"A wise plan, O prophet of the Lord Dragon." A fool plan, if she had ever heard one. That was not to say it would not work. Fool plans often did, for some reason, when men made them. Rand might even enjoy having all those people kneel to him, if he was half as arrogant as Egwene claimed. "But I cannot wait. I have been summoned, and when the Lord Dragon summons, mere mortals must obey." Someday she was going to get a chance to box Rand's heads for her need to do this. "I have to find a boat going downriver." Massima stared at her for so long that she began to grow nervous. Sweat trickled down her back and between her breasts, and it was only partly the heat. That stare would have made Mogadine sweat. Finally he nodded, fiery zealotry fading to leave only his usual dour scowl.
"Yes," he sighed. "If you have been summoned, you must go.
Go with the light and in the light. Dress more appropriately. Those who have been close to the Lord Dragon must be virtuous above all others, and meditate on the Lord Dragon and his light."
"A riverboat?" Nynaeve insisted. "You must know whenever a boat reaches Samara or any village along the river. If you could just tell me where I might find one, it would make my journey much swifter." She'd been going to say easier, but she did not think ease mattered much to Massima.
"I do not concern myself with such things," he said testily. "But you are right. When the Lord Dragon commands, you must come on the hour. I will ask. If a vessel can be found, someone will tell me of it eventually."
His eyes shifted to the other two men.
"You must see that she is safe until then. If she persists in clothing herself in this manner, she will attract men with vile thoughts. She must be protected like a wayward child until she is reunited with the Lord Dragon."
Nynaeve bit her tongue.
A willow, not an oak, when a willow was needed. She managed to mask her irritation behind a smile that had to carry all the gratitude the idiot man could wish. A dangerous idiot, however. She had to remember that. Uno and Regan made their goodbyes quickly, with more forearm clasping, and hustled her out, one on either arm, as if they thought it necessary to hurry her away from Massima for some reason. Massima appeared to have forgotten them before they reached the door. He was already frowning at the weedy man, waiting next to a bluff fellow in a farmer's coat, who was crumpling his cap in thick hands, awe painted across his broad face. She did not say a word as they retraced their steps through the kitchen, where the gray-haired woman was sucking her teeth and stirring the soup as if she had not moved in the interval. Nynaeve held her tongue while they retrieved their weapons, held it until they were out of the alleyway, into something approaching the width of a street. Then she rounded on them, shaking her finger under each nose alternately. "How dare you drag me out like that?" People passing by grinned, men ruefully, women appreciatively, though none could have had an idea what she was berating them over. "Another 5 minutes and I would have had him finding a boat today. If you ever lay hands on me again..." Uno snorted so loudly that she cut off with a start. "Another 5 bloody minutes and Massima would have bloody well laid hands on you. Or rather, he'd have said that someone should, and then someone flaming well would have. When he says something should be done, there are always 50 flaming hands or 100 or a flaming 1,000, if need be, to do it." He stalked off down the street, Regan at his side, and she had to go with them or be left. Uno paced on as if he knew she would trail after. She almost went the other way just to prove him wrong. Following had nothing to do with fear of getting lost in that rabbit warren of streets. She could have found her way out, eventually. "He had a flaming lord of the Crown High Council flogged, for half the heat in his voice that you had," the one-eyed man growled. "Contempt for the word of the Lord Dragon, he called it. Peace. Demanding what bloody right he had to comment on your flaming clothes. For a few minutes you did well enough, but I saw your face there at the end. You were ready to flaming lace into him again. The only thing worse you could have done would be to bloody name the Lord Dragon. He calls that blasphemy. As well name the flaming Dark One." Regan's topknot bobbed as he nodded. "Remember the Lady Baalome, Uno? Right after the first rumors came from Tyr naming the Lord Dragon, Nynaeve, she said something about this Randall Thor in Massima's hearing, and he called for an axe and a chopping block without pause for breath." "He had someone beheaded for that?" she said incredulously. "No," Uno muttered in disgust, "but only because she bloody well groveled when she realized he flaming meant it. She was dragged out and hung up by her flaming wrists from the back of her own coach, then strapped the bloody length of whatever village it was we were in then. Her own flaming retainers stood like a bunch of sheep-gutted farmers and watched it." "When it was done," Regan added, "she thanked Massima for his mercy, the same as Lord Aleshin did." His tone had too much pointedness to suit her. He was delivering a moral and intended her to take it in. "They had reason, Nynaeve. Theirs would not have been the first heads he has put on a stake. Yours could have been the latest, and ours with it if we'd tried to give aid. Massima plays no favorites." She drew breath. How could Massima have all this power? And not only among his own followers, apparently. But then, there was no reason lords or ladies could not be as great fools as any farmer. A good many were greater in her estimation. That idiot woman with her rings had surely been a lady. No merchant ever wore fire drops. Yet surely Gildan had laws and courts and judges. Where was the queen or the king? She could not remember which Gildan had. No one in the Two Rivers had ever had much truck with kings or queens, yet that was what they were for, them and lords and ladies, seeing justice fairly done. But whatever Massima did here was no concern of hers. She had more important problems than worrying over a flock of imbeciles who let a madman trample them. Still, curiosity made her say, "Does he mean that about trying to stop men and women looking at one another? What does he think will happen if there are no marriages, no children?
Will he stop people farming next, or weaving, or making shoes, so they can think about Randall Thor? She enunciated the name deliberately. These two went around calling him the Lord Dragon at the drop of a pin almost as much as Massima did. I will tell you this. If he tries telling women how to dress, he will start a riot. Against him. Samara must have something like a women's circle. Most places did, even if they called it something else. Even when it was not a formal arrangement at all, there were some things men just did not have the sense to see to. And they surely could and did call women down for wearing inappropriate clothes, but that was not the same as a man putting his finger into it. Women did not meddle in men's affairs. Well, no more than was necessary. And men should not meddle in women's. And I expect the men will react no better if he tries closing taverns and the like. I never knew a man yet who wouldn't cry himself to sleep if he could not put his nose in a mug now and then.
Maybe he will, Reagan said. And maybe he won't. Sometimes he orders things, and sometimes he forgets, or puts it off anyway because something more important comes along. You would be surprised, he added dryly, at what his followers will accept from him without a whimper.
He and Uno were flanking her, she realized, and watching the other folk in the street warily. Even to her, the pair of them appeared ready to draw swords in a heartbeat. If they actually thought to carry out Massima's instructions, they had another think coming.
He isn't against bloody marriage, Uno growled,
staring so hard at a peddler with meat pies on a tray that the man turned and ran without taking the coins from two women holding pies in their hands.
You're lucky he did not remember you have no husband, or he might have sent you to the Lord Dragon with one. Sometimes he picks out 300 or 400 unmarried men and as many women, and flaming well marries them. Most have never seen each other before that day. If the pigeon-gutted dirt-grubbers don't bloody complain about that, do you think they'll open their flaming mouths about ale?
Reagan muttered something under his breath, but she caught enough to narrow her eyes. Some man doesn't know how bloody lucky he is. That was what he had said. He did not even notice her glare. He was too busy scanning the street, watching against someone who might try to abscond with her like a pig in a sack. She was half tempted to take off the shawl and throw it away. He did not seem to hear her sniff, either. Men could be insufferably blind and deaf when they wished to. "At least he didn't try to steal my jewelry," she said. "Who was that fool woman who gave him hers? She could not have much sense if she had become one of Massima's followers."
"That," Uno said, "was Aleandra, Blessed of the Light, Queen of Bloody Gildan, and a dozen more titles the way you Southlanders like to pile them up."
Nynaeve stubbed her toe on a cobblestone and almost fell.
"So that is how he does it," she exclaimed, shaking off their helping hands. "If the queen is fool enough to listen to him, no wonder he can do whatever he wants."
"Not a fool," Uno said sharply, flashing a frown at her before returning to watching the street.
"A wise woman. When you bloody find yourself straddling a wild horse, you bloody well ride it the way it's bloody going if you're smart enough to pour water out of a bloody boot. You think she's smart because Massima took her rings? She's flaming smart enough to know he might demand more if she stopped wearing jewelry when she comes to him. The first time he went to her, been the other way round since, and he did take the rings right off her flaming fingers. She had strands of pearls in her hair, and he broke the strings pulling them out. All of her ladies-in-waiting were down on their knees gathering the bloody things off the floor. Aleandra even picked up a few herself."
"That doesn't sound so wise to me," she said stoutly. "It sounds like cowardice." "Whose knees were shaking because he looked at her?" a voice in her head asked. "Who was sweating herself silly? At least she had managed to face up to him."
"I did. Bending like a willow isn't the same as cowering like a mouse."
"Is she the queen or isn't she?" The two men exchanged those irritating looks, and Reagan said quietly,
"You don't understand, Nynaeve. Aleandra is the fourth to sit on the light blessed throne since we came to Gildan, and that's barely half a year. Johannin wore the crown when Massima began attracting a few crowds, but he thought Massima a harmless madman, and did nothing even when the crowds grew and his nobles told him he had to put an end to it. Johannin died in a hunting accident,
"Hunting accident," Uno interjected, sneering. A hawker who happened to be looking at him dropped his tray of pins and needles. "Not unless he didn't know one bloody end of a flaming boar spear from the other. Flaming Southlanders and their flaming game of houses." "And Elizel succeeded," Rhaegan took up. "She had the army dispersing the crowds until finally there was a pitched battle and it was the army that was chased off." "Bloody poor excuse for soldiers," Uno muttered. She was going to have to speak to him about his language again. Rhaegan nodded agreement but went on with what he had been saying. "They say Elizel took poison after that, but however she died, she was replaced by Teresia, who lasted a full 10 days after her coronation, just until she had a chance to send 2,000 soldiers against 10,000 folk who had gathered to hear Massima outside Johanna. After her soldiers were routed, she abdicated to marry a rich merchant." Nynaeve stared at him incredulously, and Uno snorted. "That is what they say," the younger man maintained. "Of course, in this land, marrying a commoner means giving up any claim to the throne forever, and whatever Baron Gorayd feels about having a pretty young wife with royal blood, I hear he was dragged from his bed by a score of Aliandra's retainers and hauled to Jeddah Palace for a wedding in the small hours of the morning. Teresia went off to live on her husband's new country estate while Aliandra was being crowned all before sunrise, and the new queen summoned Massima to the palace to tell him he would not be troubled again. Inside 2 weeks, she was calling on him. I do not know whether she really believes what he preaches, but I know she took the throne of a land on the edge of civil war, with white cloaks ready to move in, and she stopped it the only way she could. That is a wise queen, and a man could be proud to serve her, even if she is a Southlander." Nynaeve opened her mouth and forgot what she was going to say when Uno said in a casual tone, "There's a flaming white cloak following us. Don't look around, woman. You have more bloody sense than that." Her neck stiffened with the effort of keeping her eyes forward. Prickles crawled up her back. "Take the next turn, Uno. That carries us away from the main streets and the flaming gates. We can flaming lose him in the crowds." "Take it." She inhaled slowly, made her voice less shrill. "I need a sight of him." Uno glowered so fiercely that people stepped out of their way for 10 paces ahead, but they turned down the next narrow street. She shifted her head a trifle as they made the turn, just enough to peek from the edge of her eye before the corner of a small stone tavern cut off her view. The snowy cloak with the flaring sun stood out among the thin crowd. There was no mistaking that beautiful face, the face she had been sure she would see. No other white cloak than Galad could have a reason to follow her, and none to follow Uno or Rhaegan. Chapter 40. The Wheel Weaves. As soon as the building hid Galad, Nynaeve's eyes darted down the street ahead. Fury bubbled up, at herself as much as Galadadrid Damodred. "You witless woolhead!" It was a narrow way like all the rest, paved with rounded stones, lined with grey shops and houses and taverns, populated with a scattered afternoon crowd. "If you hadn't come into town, he'd never have found you." Too scattered to hide anyone. "You had to go see the Prophet. You had to go believing the Prophet would whisk you away before Mogadine gets here. When are you going to learn you can't depend on anyone but yourself?" In an instant, she made her choice. When Galad turned that corner and did not see them, he would begin looking into shops, and maybe taverns as well. "This way." Gathering her skirts, she darted into the nearest alley and pressed her back against the wall. No one glanced at her twice, furtive as she was, and what that had to say about the way things were in Samara she did not want to consider. Uno and Rhaegan were beside her before she finished setting her feet, crowding her farther down the dusty dirt alleyway, past an old splintered bucket and a rain barrel dried to the point of collapse inside its hoops. At least they were doing what she wanted, in a manner of speaking. Tense hands on long sword hilts rising above their shoulders, they were ready to protect her whether she desired it or not.
Let them, you fool. Do you think you can protect yourself?
She was certainly angry enough. Kalad, of all people. She should never have left the menagerie. A fool whim, and one that might ruin everything. She could no more channel here than against Massima. Just the possibility that Mogadine or Black Sisters were in Samara made her dependent on two men for her safety. It was enough to screw her anger tight. She could have chewed a hole in the stone wall behind her. She knew why Aes Sedai had warders, all but Reds, anyway. In her head, she did. In her heart, it just made her want to snarl. Galad appeared, threading his way slowly through the folk out in the street, eyes searching. By all reason, he should have gone on by. He should have. Yet almost immediately his gaze settled on the alleyway, on them. He did not even have the grace to appear pleased or surprised. Uno and Rhaegun moved together as Galad turned toward the alley. The one-eyed man had his sword out in the blink of an eye, and Rhaegun was scarcely slower for all he paused to push her deeper into the narrow passage. They positioned themselves one behind the other. Should Galad make it past Uno, he would still have Rhaegun to face. Nynaeve ground her teeth. She could make all these swords unnecessary, useless. She could sense the true source like a light unseen over her shoulder waiting for her embrace. She could do it, if she dared. Galad stopped at the alley mouth, cloak thrown back, one hand resting nonchalantly on his sword hilt, a picture of spring steel grace. Except for his burnished mail, he could have been at a ball.
"I do not want to kill either of you, Shinaran," he said calmly to Uno.
Nynaeve had heard Elaine and Gawain speak of Galad's sword skill, but for the first time she realized that he might really be as good as they said. At least he thought he was. Two seasoned soldiers with blades bare, and he eyed them as a wolfhound would eye a pair of lesser dogs, not seeking a fight, yet utterly confident he could take both. Never quite looking away from the two men, he addressed her.
"Someone else might have run into a shop or an inn, but you never do what is expected. Will you let me speak with you? There is no need to make me kill these men."
None of the passers-by were stopping, but even with three men blocking her view, she could see heads swiveling for a glimpse of what had drawn the white cloak, and plainly taking in the swords. Rumors would be hatching in all those minds and taking flight on wings that made dusk swallows seem slow.
"Let him by," she commanded.
When Uno and Rhaegun did not budge, she repeated herself even more firmly. They did move aside then, slowly, as much as the narrow alley would allow, yet though neither said a word, there was an air of muttering about them. Galad came by smoothly, seeming to forget the Shinarans. She suspected that believing so would be a mistake. The top-knotted men plainly did not. Aside from one of the Forsaken, she could not imagine a man she would less like to see right then, but with that face in front of her she was all too conscious of her own breathing, her own heartbeat. It was ludicrous. Why could the man not be ugly, or at least plain?
"You knew I knew that you were following." Accusation rang strongly in her voice, though she was not sure what she was accusing him of.
Not doing what she had expected and wanted, she imagined ruefully.
"I assumed as much as soon as I recognized you, Nynaeve. I remember that you generally see more than you let on."
She would not let him divert her with compliments. Look where that had gotten her with Valen Luca.
"What are you doing in Gildan? I thought you were on your way to Altara."
For a moment he stared down at her with those dark, beautiful eyes, then abruptly laughed.
"In all the world, Nynaeve, only you would ask me the question I should be asking you. Very well, I'll answer you, for all it should be the other way round. I did have orders for Salidar, in Altara, but all changed when this prophet fellow..."
"What is the matter? Are you unwell?"
Nynaeve forced her face to smoothness.
"Of course not," she said irritably. "My health is quite good, thank you very kindly."
"Salidar! Of course!" The name was like one of Aludra's fire sticks going off in her head.
All of that racking of her brain, and Galad casually handed her what she'd been unable to dig up on her own.
Now if only Massima found a ship quickly. If only she could make sure Galad would not betray them, without letting Uno and Rhaegon kill him, of course. Whatever Elaine said, Nynaeve could not believe she would appreciate having her brother cut down. Small chance he would believe Elaine was not with her.
I just cannot get over my shock at seeing you.
A small patch on mine, when I learned you had slipped out of Sienda.
Sternness became that handsome face to an unfortunate degree, but his tone offset it, somewhat. He could have been lecturing a small girl who had sneaked out of the house after her bedtime to climb trees.
I was sick near to death with worry. What under the light possessed you? Have you any idea of the risks you ran? And to come here, of all places. Elaine always chooses to saddle a horse at the gallop if she can, but I thought that you, at least, had more sense. This so-called prophet... He cut off, eyeing the other two men. Uno had grounded his sword point, scarred hands folded atop the pommel. Rhaegon appeared to be inspecting his blade's edge to the exclusion of everything else.
I have heard rumors, Galad went on slowly, that he is Shinaran.
You cannot have been witless enough to get yourself mixed up with him.
There was too much question in that for her taste by far.
Neither of them is the prophet, Galad, she said wryly. I've known them both for some little time, and I can assure you of that. Uno, Rhaegon, unless you intend to prune your toenails, put those things up.
Well?
They hesitated before doing as they were told, Uno grumping under his breath and glaring, but they did it finally. Men usually responded to a firm voice. Most did. Sometimes, anyway.
I hardly thought they were, Nynaeve.
Galad's tone, even more arid than hers, made her bristle, but when he went on, he sounded annoyed rather than superior, and worried, which made her bristle even more, of course. He all but gave her palpitations, and he had the nerve to be worried.
I do not know what you and Elaine have fallen into here, and I do not care, so long as I can extract you from it before you are hurt. Trade is slow on the river, but a suitable boat of some sort should call in the next few days. Let me know where I can find you, and I will secure you passage to somewhere in Altara. From there you can make your way to Camelin.
She gaped in spite of herself.
You mean to find us a ship?
It is all I can do now. He sounded apologetic and shook his head as if arguing with himself. I cannot escort you to safety. My duty is here.
We wouldn't want to take you from your duty, she said, a touch breathless.
If he wanted to misunderstand, let him. The most she had hoped for was that he would leave them be.
He seemed to feel the need to defend himself.
It is hardly safe to send you off alone, but a boat will take you away before the entire border explodes, which it will, soon or late. All it needs is one spark, and the Prophet is sure to strike it if no one else does. You must see to getting yourselves to Camelin, you and Elaine. All I ask is your promise that you will go there. The tower is no place for either of you, or for...
He clamped his teeth shut, but he might as well have gone ahead and named Egwene.
It could not hurt, having Galad looking for a boat too. If Massima could forget whether he intended to close the taverns, he could forget to have anyone find a riverboat. Especially if he thought a convenient bout of forgetfulness might keep her there to further his own plans. It could not hurt, if she could trust Galad. If she could not, then she would have to hope he was not as good with that sword as he thought he was. A stark thought, but not so stark as what might happen, would happen, if he proved untrustworthy.
I am what I am, Galad, and Elaine is the same.
Dodging around Massima had put a bad taste on her tongue. A little white tower sidestepping was as close as she could come.
And you are what you are now.
She raised her eyebrows significantly at his white cloak. That lot hates the tower, and they hate women who can channel. Now that you are one of them, why shouldn't I think there will be 50 of you after me inside the hour, trying to put an arrow in my back if they can't haul me off to a cell? Me and Elaine as well.
Galad's head jerked in irritation. Or maybe he was offended.
How often must I tell you? I would never let harm come to my sister, or to you. It truly was annoying, realizing that she was annoyed at the pause that made it clear she was an afterthought. She was not some silly girl to lose her wits because a man had eyes that somehow managed to be melting and incredibly penetrating at the same time. "If you say it so," she told him, and his head tossed again. "Tell me where you are put up, and I will bring word or send it as soon as I locate a suitable vessel." If Elaine was right, he could no more lie than could an Aes Sedai who had sworn the three oaths, but still she hesitated. A mistake here could be her last. She had a right to take risks for herself, but this risk involved Elaine, too, and Tom and Julin, for that matter. They were her responsibility, whatever they wanted to think. But she was here, and the decision had to be hers. Not that it might be any other way, frankly. "Light woman, what more do you want of me?" Galad growled, half raising his hands as though to grab her shoulders. Uno's blade was between them in a flash of bright steel, but Elaine's brother actually brushed it aside like a twig and paid it no more mind than one. "I mean no harm to you, now or ever. I swear it by my mother's name. You say that you are what you are. I know what you are, and what you are not. Perhaps half the reason I wear this," he touched an edge of his snowy cloak, "is because the tower sent you out, you and Elaine and Egwene, for the light knows what reason, when you are what you are. It was like sending a boy who has just learned to hold a sword into battle, and I will never forgive them. There is still time for both of you to turn aside. You do not have to carry that sword. The tower is too dangerous for you or my sister,